one of our meetings in the first year. And as a result, I think you're going to learn some things that will help you in your practice and maybe keep you from having to come back to see us. With that, we're going to go to our first tab, is tab number one, in the matter of Dr. Joseph Greer. And I see Dr. Greer has joined us virtually. So anyone else who's in participation in this meeting virtually, we need you to mute yourself until it's your turn to speak. And then when called upon or when it's appropriate, you can unmute yourself to speak to us. So let's go ahead and get started with the formal interview. I'm Dr. Guarino. This is the time and place for the formal interview in the matter of Dr. Joseph L. Greer. In case numbers 2020-013, 2021-001, and 2021-035. This matter will be heard by the board pursuant to the authority given to it by ARS 32-924F. Dr. Greer, I'd like you to introduce yourself.
I'm Dr. Joseph Greer.
Thank you. And are you represented by legal counsel today?
I am not.
Thank you. Dr. Greer, you have received a letter informing you of the matters to be discussed today and possible actions the board may take at this formal interview. As a reminder, those options include dismissal, issuing a non-disciplinary advisory letter, issuing you a disciplinary letter of concern, censure, ordering restitution, placing you on probation, assessing a civil penalty, or referring this matter to a formal hearing. If you have any questions on the possible actions that we may take, you can ask now.
Not this time.
Thank you. The purpose of this formal interview is to inquire into the facts and circumstances of the cases. We have read all the materials that you have submitted. If you have any additional materials you would like to present to the board, please do so now.
I do not. Yep.
Thank you. During the course of the interview, it is necessary to refer to clients or patients by initials only. This proceeding is being recorded by a court reporter, and as a result, it is important that everyone speaks loudly and clearly and that only one person speaks at a time. I'm going to ask the other board members and staff to introduce themselves for the record. Let's start right here.
Angela Powell, public member.
And Dr. Richard Guarino, chairman, professional member.
Dr. Stephen Knopf, professional member.
Justin Bohol, interim executive director.
Jackie Kennel, investigator.
Jamie Shapiro, deputy director.
Okay, and Dr. Bennett?
Dr. Wayne Bennett, vice chairman.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like witnesses to be sworn in by our court reporter. So do we have anyone besides Dr. Greer for these cases? Okay. Dr. Greer, we're going to go ahead and going to be sworn in at this point. You raise your right hand.
Sir, do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to begin by asking our board's executive director, Mr. Bohol, to give a brief summary of the allegations in this case, and then you will be given an opportunity to respond. Following your response, the board may wish to ask you questions. Mr. Bohol, will you please give us a brief summary?
Yes. For case number 2020-013 and case 2021-001, and 2021-035, the allegations for formal interview are improper treatment, improper billing, patient abandonment, noncompliance with a board subpoena, failure to properly supervise, failure to complete continuing education, a breach of doctor-patient confidentiality, failure to release medical records, failure to maintain adequate records, and practicing while license is suspended.
Thank you. Dr. Greer, we would like you now to give you an opportunity to respond and to the executive director, the interim executive director's summary of the cases before us. Do you have anything that you would like to say at this point?
I have sent all the records requested for my classes and for the financial aspect of that, which was probably the biggest part there, showing that I had done everything involved. The only thing I had not done is putting the number on the receipt back into the website, as far as I understand it that way, and didn't have the records showing that stuff. On the records, when I did my license in 2020, I did change my residence on that, and then the office, I should say, and I thought that was enough to get through that. I did not receive the subpoenas at first. They're returned back to you, so I had no idea that I had been suspended. I did receive a phone call, and I asked them to get back to me, tell me more. They did not do that. They didn't have that information at that time because their computers were down. On the cases involved, the record where the wrong records or x-ray was given to the patient, she contacted me, as 14 months later, and I gave those, had her come in, and I did give those to her. I had her sign a record request to return back within 30 days, as she mentioned in her complaint. The other ones involved here, the patients were told by staff members, and this was not brought to my attention at that time, that they could not come in or were told not to come in by them. I did contact that patient even at that time and told them that they could come in any time. I offered them free care to make things more efficient that way, and she did not do that. And I don't think of anything else. So the part of being, I went through the reinstatement with Mrs. Shapiro and reenacted that, was graciously given the opportunity to reinstate my license at that time, and I did that, and also showing the records been moved to the new location. I do appreciate the leniency of the board going through things for me and getting me back so I could practice. That's about all I have right now.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Greer. So I'm going to ask my board members if they have any questions for you. and we're going to go through one by one and see. And I think for simplicity, we should probably take these case by case so that we know exactly what we're talking about. And so we're going to start with the first case, which is 2020-013. And I want to say, you know, after our last meeting, we gave you the opportunity to step up and demonstrate that you had paid all of your licensing fees and completed all of your continuing education, and staff had confirmed that you had. And so I appreciate that. I feel like a big reason why we're here today goes back to your noncompliance with updating your address to the board. You are required within 30 days to notify the board of any address change and keep us current with your phone number. Had you done that back a couple of years ago when your license went on administrative suspension because you had not completed the renewal properly on the online portal, you paid the fee, but you didn't complete the process. And as a result, you automatically went into an administrative suspension status. And so the protocol is to send you a letter and let you know that you cannot treat patients anymore because you are administratively suspended. And so in the past, you've told us that you didn't get that letter. And you told us, and you continued to treat patients for a couple of years with the same thing happening, which included in the the following year. You also failed to complete the renewal process properly. So we still didn't have a correct address for you until just recently. And so all of this, I think, could have been avoided if we knew exactly where you lived and if you had acknowledged that you had received some of the mailings that we had sent out to you that didn't come back to us. So with that said, let's start with Dr. Kanoff, specifically regarding case 2020-013. Do you have any questions for Dr. Greer?
Yeah, and I agree, Dr. Greer, with everything you just said. Dr. Greer, I know we don't have the patient here to speak. My understanding is that you had some follow-up with the patient after the incident and finding out about it from staff. If I read everything correctly, the staff that mishandled the situation, they were terminated, correct?
Yes. Yes.
And they're no longer employed with you. So could you just describe a little bit more what the resolution with the patient was? Are they back under your care? Did they take you up on the offer that you provided them, or have you not seen the patient again?
I have not seen the patient again. I did send, I've called her at that time and offered her, as I said, free care, equal and more than what she had paid for. And she did not want to do that. And then she said, she said she would get back to me, and I never heard back from her again.
There were no additional requests from the patient after that interaction? You've had another communication?
No, sir.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Ms. Powell, do you have any questions for Dr. Greer?
No, I don't.
Dr. Bennett?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, very clearly. Thank you.
And Dr. Greer, hi, Dr. Bennett. And I hope that I'm not shifting cases here because my notes are combining all of three of these cases. So, Mr. Chairman, correct me if I stray. But a couple of things. First, Dr. Greer, can you just confirm that, in fact, the x-rays of a patient were given to the wrong patient, that a patient left your office with the x-rays of another patient?
If it's the case you're talking
about. Excuse me, Dr. Bennett, that is the next case that we're going to get to.
Then we'll come back to that. So then the one question that I have here, and I believe, yeah, this is primarily an issue of the notification of licensure. And what I think that we need clarity on when Dr. Greer actually became aware of the fact that he was administratively suspended. And specifically, there was a phone conversation that I think we need to, and I believe that Ms. Kennel was present on that phone conversation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And is she present currently?
Yes.
Can we confirm with her that Dr. Greer was clearly informed of his administrative suspension without any lack of clarity during that conversation?
Yes, sir, he was.
Okay.
So my notes indicate that there were two verbal Dr. Greer had testified in the past that he didn't receive anything in writing regarding the suspension, but Dr. Kolash and Ms. Kennel had a conversation with him back in April 27th of this year, and told him that he was on an administrative suspension and that he is not supposed to treat patients, and he acknowledged that he was. And then Ms. Kennel, in our board materials, said that she spoke to him again on May 18th of this year in preparation for last month's board meeting, and she confirmed with him that he was still treating patients even though he knew that he was not supposed to be. because they had the conversation a month earlier or about 3 weeks earlier. Ms. Connell, is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you. All right, Dr. Bennett, does that clarify?
Yeah, and therein lies my concern. Having some lack of clarity due to administrative issues is one thing. Stating, as he did just now to the board, that he was not clear about the content of that conversation, when in fact our staff are stating that the conversation was quite clear, gives rise to concern to me.
Can I ask one question?
Yes. Go ahead, Dr. Greer.
When I had that conversation, the gentleman that was talking to me said he could not. I said, tell me what's going on involved. He said he could not do that because his computer was not working properly, and he would get back to me. And I never received any phone call until, like I said, that one in May. And I asked her to also, she said that she did not have that also at that time. So I was trying to understand what was involved, what I did that was wrong, and what was involved that way. So that was the clarification. Yes, I did say that something was involved, and I was, when I was talking to the gentleman on the phone, maybe Ms. Kendra was on there. I'm not sure she was. And I said, once again, can you help me understand what's going on? What's involved that way? I was not trying to degrade anybody or do anything else involved that way. I was trying to understand what the heck was going on. And once again, my phone number had never changed, as they called and talked to me and trying to acknowledge that. My information and stuff I had done in an email, I thought. And then also when I changed the location of my office, I changed that address on that involvement there. However, with the non-completion of putting those numbers or whatever, saying that I had on my receipt and I didn't know I had to do that, that was the problem. So I was not clear. They said, yes, you had, and yes, they did say that. However, I was trying to understand and give me clarification. They said they would have to get back to me. That did not happen.
Dr. Greer, outside of the reasons for administrative suspension and providing clarity there, were you made aware that your license was suspended?
The phone call, somebody in the phone call said that I had, yes. However, I was trying to find out for a while, and they said they would get back to me quickly. And I said, would that be today or tomorrow? When? They did not get back to me on that information. I was under the assumption that I would have to have something in writing saying something that involved me that way. They have my email address that has not changed ever, and the phone number, and that's involved that way.
If you were told your license was on suspension, why then would you continue to treat?
I was not even sure what the heck that entailed, involved there, because no one ever got back to me to clarify that, as they said they would.
So your testimony is you asked what suspended means on your license, and they said they'd get back to you?
I asked them what was involved, the whole situation, and they said they didn't have the information at that time, and they would get back to me. And I was in the same thing. I was in the trying to clarify with that.
I have no further questions. Sorry, Dr. Bennett.
No, thank you, Dr.
Just a point of clarification. This is Dr. Guarino. I want to make sure the timeline is correct on this. Dr. Greer, is it true that you were contacted by mail regarding your practice location, your most current practice location, which is on Fifth Street, that inspired you to call the board to ask what was going on in April of 2021? Called the board, and the board called you back the next day and let you know that you were on an administrative suspension. Is that correct?
The reason why I called the board, the case that was back in, if I remember, it was 2019, I had to send my records that you asked for again, said that my staff member had not sent those correctly as she was supposed to, and I had to send those back to there. And then all of a sudden the COVID thing happened, and that was involved there. So that's why I had called 4-5 times asking what the form of that case was, what was involved with that. That's why I called.
Okay, so in April of this year, you were calling to follow up on a case from with a complaint from 2019.
Yes.
From that date of service, which is our case 2020-013. And
yes.
And so then board staff called you back, which was Dr. Kolash and Ms. Kennel, and they informed you that you were on an administrative suspension and you were not to be treating patients, which I'm guessing was a surprise to you. You're saying it was because you were saying that you didn't know that. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And you were informed that you were not supposed to be treating patients. So you're saying that you wanted to know why and you didn't know why, but you were told you were on an administrative suspension at that point.
Is that a question? I'm sorry.
You can confirm that, you know, that you were in fact told that you were on an administrative suspension and you were asking for more information about it, but you knew that you were on an administrative suspension at that point, and that was April of the 27th of 2021.
I asked at that time, clarify what that entailed, what couldn't I do, and they said they'd have to get back to me.
Okay. So I appreciate concise answers because we have a agenda we need to get through. So thank you for that. So you took the information that you were on an administrative suspension verbally, and while you were waiting for clarity as to why you were on the administrative suspension, you continued to treat patients, which you testified previously to. Correct?
Yes. I did not know that I couldn't treat, but go ahead.
Okay. Thank you just for clarifying that. Now, Dr. Bennett, I want to come back to you because we interrupted you 3 times now.
Well, they were excellent interruptions because they basically established my concern here that it's one thing to have an administrative issue with regard to information, but we can presume that it's the responsibility of any licensee to understand what suspension means, administrative suspension. That's why we have a jurisprudence. So,
board chair, board members, this is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. This would be more appropriate for deliberations. Now we should be asking questions of the respondent.
Okay, point, so we're in the fact-finding portion of our interview. So, Dr. Bennett, do you have any more questions that need clarity out of Dr. Greer?
Not at this time.
Okay, and I want to, at this point, officially acknowledge if the complainant is available and present with the initials R, as in Richard, L as in Larry. The complainant, RL, present. Okay, one more call to the complainant, RL. Okay. So if we can shift gears now into case number 2021-001, which is the one regarding the X-ray CD that was administered to the patient with the wrong label on it, so the right patient name with the wrong patient's information on the X-ray. I'd like to ask, we'll start with Ms. Powell if she has any questions for Dr. Greer regarding that case.
Yes, thank you. Dr. Greer, what was the issue with having her write her name on a piece of paper in her birth date?
What I had for? The patient to let them know that I had those had X-rays had returned back to me. They were not on a disc yet. They were hard copies. And I asked her to sign a paper that she knows that she needs to bring those back to me, and that was that I would have know exactly the date and time she could do that. I asked her to bring them back within 30 days.
Do you not have a form to do that with?
I did at that time. However, I just moved. I could not find it at that time, so I asked her to do what I just said. So,
You gave her a disc initially. Why didn't you give her a disc the second time?
I did. That was improper. They were labeled with her name onto it, and the wrong patient's information was on there. She went back to me 14 months later, she said.
So the x-rays are digitized, right? They're not films.
Though there are films, I took pictures of those and gave those to her.
You took pictures of films and gave her the films? I'm not clear. Explain.
Yes, I did. At that time, I took pictures, digitally pictures, and I gave her the diskette with that. When she came back to those, after she said they didn't have those, I asked her to come by the office. She came by. I gave her the hard copies, and I had her sign that paper, knowing that I would like to have those back at that time, and they're my responsibility for the 5 years.
I guess I'm just still confused as to why she would need both. Why didn't you just give her an x-ray report or give her the x-rays and have her sign a release? Or if you're digitizing, if they're on a disc, put them on a disc. The disc would be a copy. You'd have the originals. She wouldn't need to bring anything back. That would be the easiest way to do that, right?
You are correct. However, at that time, I did not have that. It was a brief situation come back that way, and I didn't have those ready at that time. So I gave her the hard copies, and I asked her to bring those back.
Okay. Now I understand. Thank you. That's the only question I had.
How about Dr. Bennett? Do you have any questions regarding this specific case?
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Simply to confirm that Dr. Greer acknowledges that the wrong patient's information was given to a patient. You do acknowledge that, correct?
Yes, a staff member had mislabeled the diskette they had, and that was given to them. That was the problem.
Okay, and you understand that that is your responsibility?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay, that's all I have.
I asked the patient also, again, recently, if they wanted another copy of those, and she said yes, and this is in a text, and she gave me her new address, and I asked her to supply me with the other x-rays that were diskette that were given to her before, and she did not. I asked her twice for that, and she did not respond back, bringing those back to me, or what happened to those.
That all sounds fine. The issue, however, is that the wrong patient information got into the patient's hands in the first place, and that's, to me, a significant issue.
Yes.
Okay. How about Dr. Knopf?
I don't have any additional questions. Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Powell.
I just one final question, if I may. Dr. Greer, what have you put in place policies or protocols to avoid this happening again in the future? If I want my x-rays from you or any of my records from you and I come in and say, can I get copies? What do you do?
I have them right the date they put those on there. I give them to them within a week situation that way, and I can hand it to them. If they want to give me a notice in the form for it, they'll be there ready for them.
How do you know they're not going to get the wrong films or the wrong records? Or
I check those out.
You
sure.
Check everything before it goes out.
That's what I had done before, but the staff member had picked up the wrong x-rays and put a wrong label on them. Wrong disc, I should say.
And so I'm asking you what policy or protocol you have in place to avoid that. How do you keep that from happening again, getting the wrong label on the wrong x-rays?
I keep them next to each other that way, and they're copied off films that are on the computer. So
thank
I
you.
Have that there. I check it and do it myself. I no longer have staff to do that. That's one reason why I have that.
Okay. No further questions, Ms. Powell?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's move on then to the most recent case, 2021-035. And so in this case, Dr. Barry Ron drove by his old office, noticed that you had some signage up front and that alerted us to your most current address, which is on the Fifth Street address. Let's start with Dr. Bennett for this one. Dr. Bennett, do you have any questions regarding the most recent case, -035?
I do not. I think the facts are self-evident.
Okay. And Dr. Knopf?
I have none.
Ms. Powell?
I have none.
Okay. All right. Then let us go to, I want to make sure in our case 2021-001 that nobody was signed in to speak for that one or that nobody is present for that. And that would be the patient with the initial D as in David, V as in Victor. Complainant DV, are you present? You're present. You may be muted and we can't hear you. So at this point, Dr. Greer, do you have any comments you would like to make before I ask my board members if they have any final questions for you before we go into deliberation?
As I've said before, I asked for information when they did talk to me about the vault, what it entails, when it was brought on, why wasn't I notified. I do have an email address. I would think I would use a letter or... If I had any information given to me, I would have stopped and done exactly what I was told to do. I had contacted the board several times over the last year trying to understand about the patient way back in 2019, MR. And that's why I called. I was trying to get involved that way, understand there, and take care of everything involved. Because of the same information had not been simply sent to the board on that case, and that was the problem. The biggest problem I have is I did not fulfill that completion of the number back onto the state website and that involvement that way. Nothing was done on purpose. Nothing was been improperly. I had to show the financial aspect. In fact, the records, I was told, on the board thing, talk about the financial aspect. It had been done on time, but I did not owe any more. And when you're filling out the licensure request for the next year, you have to put that information on there, which I had. And does that not show, is that not kept there? Or is that just blown off or discarded when that phone, that little number is not back on the website? That's my question, because I said every year I had done that, and that had been gone back to, and then nobody seemed to have any record of that payment or anything else. And then I found out that you did have that on the financial records of the state by the board member that way, or not board member, I should say the office staff. So I was trying to understand that's involved that way. I did not try to stand up and try to cause problems or try to fill my nose anything else that way. I always ask the question, what was involved with that? How was it? And they said they were going to get back to me, and no one did.
Okay, thank you. And I think that's a fair question. So to staff, if somebody doesn't complete the renewal process, what happens? Are there eyes on the materials, or are we just... They just don't get submitted. They don't come to us.
That's correct. If the form is not completed entirely, it is not submitted to the board. So we have no record other than the payment, which is through a separate system, that any documentation was received.
Okay. Does that clarify, Dr. Greer? So when you failed to successfully complete your renewal, we did not get an address update.
It does answer that question. I'm just trying to understand... I don't know. It seems that there's a problem with the website. Anyway, I do understand that now.
All right. Thank you. And so
I'm sorry. since I did receive a email each time saying they didn't have as a receipt and that I had that, I was under the assumption that it had been all taken care of properly.
I understand. So, you received confirmation of payment, but not renewal.
Well, it says you have succeeded, completed everything involved that way. So that's what, that's the only thing I'm trying to go off of. But I know it's not now.
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to review the exact language in the email, but I believe the email states you've successfully completed the payment portion. Please return to the renewal and include that information on the renewal and submit it, because your renewal is not complete until that document is submitted. And we do include the renewal receipt that confirms the dates that you're eligible to practice and when your new expiration is in that renewal form. So that is the renewal receipt that is sent out digitally, so that both the doctor and board staff have a copy.
Thank you. Okay. So, Mr. Bohol, before we go into deliberations, do you have anything else that you would like to say at this point to clarify anything?
The only thing I would note, I believe that there was two separate conversations between Dr. Kolash and Ms. Kennel. I was not privy to those conversations, but what was relayed to me, there was the initial conversation in which he was notified that he was on administrative suspension and needed to cease practicing. And then there was a separate conversation on what needed to occur to get that rectified. But those were two separate conversations. But he was properly noticed verbally that he needed to cease practicing at that time.
Okay. Thank you. And so we're about to enter into deliberations. I guess I have one question for our legal counsel. Is it important that he claims he did not receive a written notification of the administrative suspension and that it was done verbally? That matter for the sake of any action that we might take today? And I'll, you know, take your time with the answer on that. I think we can enter into deliberations while we wait for that opinion. This concludes the portion of the formal interview, which the board hears testimony, and the board will now deliberate and decide what to do in this matter. So, Dr. Greer, you can mute your mic. We're done asking you questions, and you're done giving us input. The board is now going to deliberate on what we would like to do in the cases before us.
Thank you,
Board Chair, members of the board. This is Seamus Monahan, Assistant Attorney General. There's no requirement in here that you be noticed in writing. It's just by operation of law that it automatically is suspended.
Thank you. Okay, so board members, we've got a lot of information in front of us with three cases and lots of allegations. We can tackle this one allegation at a time with each case, and you can chime in on if you think that the allegation is appropriate or not appropriate, and then at the end of that, someone will need to adopt findings of facts and conclusions of law if we decide to take any actions today, which could include civil penalties, et cetera, with, you know, the normal things that we can do. So let's start with case 2020-013 and take a look at the allegations with me.
Mr. Chair, maybe a question on order of operations here. I know that a renewal was also submitted for this gentleman. So do we need to tackle that first, or do we?
The reinstatement?
Yeah.
So staff did reinstate his license.
Okay.
And later on in our agenda, the board will ratify that.
Okay.
There's no reason not to.
Very good. All right.
Okay. Okay, so I am looking at case 2020-013. I'm looking at allegation number one for improper treatment and refusing treatment in that case. Do we find that significant?
Mr. Chair, I do not. I don't believe that he was aware of this interaction with the patient and having the patient get dismissed by the office manager.
Okay. Anybody else?
I would agree with you, Dr. Staff.
Okay.
As do I. This is Dr. Bennett. I agree.
Okay. And then along with that, there's an allegation number two of improper billing, and that was specifically regarding records that were never received and were eventually received this year. Any signs of improper billing that we're concerned about?
None for me. Could I just make a starting point with the allegations? Do you just want to go in order?
I want to go in order because everybody may have different opinions. Okay. I think it would be easier to decide it that way. So maybe when I read out the allegation, if you find it concerning, you can go ahead and speak your piece. So anybody for improper billing? I think that's significant. Okay, what about the third one for patient abandonment? I didn't think that was significant. It was, you know, a communication between staff and the patient was late to the appointment and couldn't make that one. It didn't mean she could never come back. All right, but I do think we have evidence of noncompliance of the board subpoena. It wasn't signed. Records didn't come in when they were requested. So that's number four. Does anybody else have any concerns with that one?
I'm just in agreement with that.
So am I.
As am I. As I stated earlier, Mr. Chairman, it's incumbent upon any licensee to have a baseline understanding of what the law is. It is not the responsibility of the board. You know, the board can do things as a courtesy and by way of clarification. But I believe that reasonable efforts were made by the board, and I believe that the responsibility of understanding what the law is, and I believe that Dr. Greer was aware of the act of being suspended and was negligent in failing to stop practicing at that time.
Okay. And so if four is true, five would also be true. That's unprofessional conduct. Correct?
Correct.
And then we had a allegation number six for that case was failed to supervise his employee with the mislabeling of the information that went out of the office and the or not that particular case, that was the other case, but that was failure to supervise his office manager for having that discussion with the patient that said that she couldn't come in because she was late to her appointment. Is anyone concerned about that one? I look at that as more of a communication error. I don't think that one's serious. Okay. And then allegation number seven was a failure to comply with continuing education. Staff has confirmed with me that we do have all of the continuing education requirements met from 2017 to present. So we can strike that one off the list. And then allegation number eight was practicing while his license was suspended, which we have evidence of over the address change notification, and also that he received that we did send out mail notices that never came back to us, which is confirmation of receipt by somebody. Okay. So it looks like we have concerns mostly with allegations number 4, 5, and 8 for case 2020-013. Is that correct?
Yep. I'm in agreement.
Okay. So let's move on then to case number 2021-001. Is anyone concerned with allegation one that there was a breach of doctor-patient confidentiality?
Yes, I think that's very serious.
Ms. follow, Dr. Yes. Bennett, yes?
Yes.
Okay. And then we have evidence of noncompliance with the subpoena, again, for allegation number two. Failure to release medical records, or do you look at that more of releasing someone else's medical records on accident?
I think that it's serious enough that we need to address it in terms of he has no protocol or check and balance in place to make sure that doesn't happen again in the future.
Okay. So Ms. Powell, yes on number three. Mm-hmm. How about making false statements regarding charging for the x-ray and not being part of the examination or elsewhere?
I think that one's hard to validate.
Okay. Anyone else?
I think Dr. Greer needs to be a little bit clearer with financial policies with his patients. That happens. It happens frequently, and it shouldn't. And patients get very confused by that.
Okay, so you're at yes on number four.
Mm-hmm.
How about failing to maintain records?
Same.
Okay. Agreed.
So you have concerns about that. And then six, we already know that he was practicing while on a suspended license. And then number seven, the unprofessional conduct related to the above. Then number eight, at the time, we didn't have the continuing ed for 18 and 19, but since then we do have it, so I say we strike that one from the list now that we do have it. Okay. And then what about the final case, 2021-035?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that there's nothing in this charge that has not already been covered.
Okay. Anyone else want to weigh in on that?
Mr. Chair, I believe that we would ask that if you have found a violation in 2021-035 of practicing without a license or any other concerns, that be stated on the record. Thank you.
Okay, so we do have concerns that he did continue to practice while he was verbally notified at that address that he was on an administrative suspension.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
With regard to his suspended license, I can see where, because it's happened in the past, where doctors get confused about the application, thinking it's completed. I think in Dr. Gere's mind, he was never suspended, so he was having a hard time comprehending that. Right or wrong, I know where the points are, but perhaps consider a little bit of lenience on him practicing without a license, because he did always have his license. It was an administrative error that caused this to happen.
Well, it was an administrative error that he caused.
Correct.
Okay, so you're saying you don't think he was deviant in trying to practice without a license. Obviously, there were mistakes that were made.
Yes, I did not think that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is Dr. Bennett, and my comment on that is I would agree with everything right up until April of 2021. At that point, I believe that he became negligent by having been informed clearly that his license was in suspension and intentionally and knowingly deciding to move forward. That's inappropriate and negligent.
I'm in agreement with that. You know, when we go through the process to get licensed, before we're licensed in the state, you know, we know we're not supposed to be treating patients. And so just because you have decades of momentum of treating patients doesn't mean that you take that for granted and just continue to treat patients. Once you're notified of administrative suspension status, you should cease that day.
And what about patient care, Mr. Chairman?
Pardon me?
Not to be the devil's advocate, but what about patient care? If you are asked to cease and you notify me today and I stop right away, what about all the patients that are scheduled today, tomorrow, the next? I mean, we take time to get a cover doctor maybe, but are we neglecting patients? Does that become an abandonment issue?
I don't think that overrides not having an active license.
Okay,
so anything else that we missed on the latest case on 2021-035? I know that was under a weather to open, and it just came to us. We don't have a list of allegations for that one, do we? We combined them all.
Yeah, those are 20.
Okay.
Page 24, 28.
All right. So for logistical purposes at this point, now that we've identified the allegations of concern, we don't have to list each case individually. We can, if this is a combined formal interview, we can make decisions on. Okay. Okay, for the overlapping allegations that we find.
I think how we would plan to draft it would be under the findings of fact, list each case and what you found was a violation in the findings of fact separately, and then under conclusions of law, we would draft any of the overlapping violations, and then your order could be inclusive of what you would like to see remedy all three cases.
Okay. All right. So that said, any board members feeling articulate this morning? Want to cite the findings of fact that we find appropriate for the individual allegations? But do you want to make a motion?
For case 013, allegation number 4, noncompliance with board subpoena, I think we've got clear evidence that a lot of this arose from the fact that we didn't have an address change on file and a proper way to notice the doctor. So in accordance with ARS 32924A5 on professional or dishonorable conduct of character likely to deceive or defraud the public or tending to discredit the profession, I think we find allegation 4 number true. True.
So what we need to do is just list the findings of fact of the individual, and then we'll go back and cite all the citations of law and apply applicable rules that relate to them. So the first motion will be for adopting findings of fact. To go through each allegation and cite the allegations without the conclusions of law yet.
Okay. Then I'd make the motion
and we'll do it case by case. So
for case 0 ending in 013 to adopt allegation number 4, noncompliance with board subpoena, allegation 5, unprofessional conduct, and allegation number 8, practicing while license is suspended.
Okay, and then how about for the next case?
And what would those specific findings be?
Findings for allegation 4, there were issues in communications where we were sending proper notes, which weren't being replied to by the defendant. And number 5, let me get there. Unprofessional conduct. Again, this ties into noncompliance with the board subpoena, so not responding in a timely manner or providing full records. And unprofessional conduct also ties to allegation number 8, practicing while license is suspended. We've got clear evidence that patients were seen after notification was provided.
Okay.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Are we making one motion for all findings of fact for all three charges, or are we making three separate motions of fact, findings of fact for each charge?
We'll be making them for each.
Okay. All right. So that's
The motion.
That's the motion for that particular case, and I'll need a second.
Second.
Okay. Any further discussion? And, you know, this is an opportunity when we go into discussion. If Dr. Kanoff identified any findings of fact that you agreed with or disagreed with, you know, you can say why, or you can add on to, you know, why you thought that the failure to comply with the subpoena or whatever you would like to do. So that said, I'll call for the question. Those in favor of adopting findings of fact number 4, 5, and 8 in case 2020-013, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Are there any opposed? Okay. We have 4 ayes that have it. And so now we'll need another motion to adopt findings of fact for the next case for 2021-001.
All right. This is Dr. Kanoff. I'll make the motion to adopt findings of fact for allegations number 1, breach of doctor-patient confidentiality. We've got clear evidence that wrong records were supplied to a patient, and I don't know that I'm convinced at the time that there was effort to remediate or get those records back in a timely fashion. We'd also include allegation number 2, noncompliance with subpoena, similar to the previous case. Because of the lack of address, we couldn't properly notice or receive files in a timely manner or complete files for allegation number 2. I've got allegation number 5, failure to maintain adequate records. This is reflected by really the lack of organization that led to providing the patient with incorrect file. Lack of organization or policy and procedure in the office. Allegation 6, practicing chiropractic on a suspended license. Similar to the previous case, we have testimony stating that care was provided after verbally noticed. And then allegation number 7, unprofessional conduct. This is really related to the disorganization or mismanagement of patient files and records, as well as practicing while the license is suspended.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so allegations, you said 1, 2, 5, 6, and 7?
Yep, and I think someone might want to add something else, but we'll...
Okay, if that's the case, it'll be, have to be a second motion, or it'll have to be a, your motion will have to die and we'll have to redo it. So is there a second on that?
Could okay, I request so for that we read back again?
I'm sorry, Dr. Bennett.
Would you please read back the list of items in motion?
The motion was for case 2021-001, allegations number 1, 2, 5, 6, and 7. So that did not include 3 and 4, which were the fail to release medical records and the false statements of number 4, which you, I believe, had identified with Ms. Powell that you thought those were important earlier.
Can you read number 4, please? I have a different document in front of me.
Number 4 here, Dr. Bennett, is making false statements.
And that was from the original board brief.
Okay. I actually have no objection to any of the items on the motion and would second.
I think Ms. Powell seconded already. Oh. So we were in discussion. Okay, so I'll call for the question. Those in favor of findings of fact 1, 2, 5, 6, and 7 as listed, signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. And Mr. Chairman, may I comment on my vote?
Yes.
I have concerns here that I would like to go on record with regard to, and I believe that ultimately may impact the recommendations that we make relative to these allegations. My concern is this. I, having reviewed Dr. Greer's records, I found them to be very good. I was impressed by the quality of his records. And I found a pretty significant inconsistency with that kind of organized methodology and his response to this board situation. And I have some concerns, frankly, about some competency issues. And I hesitate to bring it up, but I feel compelled to with regard to our responsibility to protect the public. And for at this point, you know, we're assuming that there is no issue there, but I believe that with regard to our overall ruling of this case, I believe that some supervision or monitoring of what his status is in the future is going to be appropriate.
Okay, thanks for explaining your vote. So the ayes have it, and the findings of fact are adopted. And so the next case is 2021-035. Is there a motion to adopt a finding of fact, perhaps, of treating Long Island a suspended license?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I would make the motion to adopt the findings of fact for providing care while on a suspended license for this one.
Okay. There, a second.
A second.
Okay. And for a discussion, in this case specifically, Dr. Greer had a verbal conversation with Ms. Kennel and Dr. Kolash when he was our executive director. He was verbally told that he was on an administrative suspension and then and not to practice. And then about 3 weeks later, there was another verbal conversation with Ms. Kennel, and he, as they were preparing for the upcoming board meeting from last month, and he was advised again that he was on an administrative suspension, and he told her at that point that he was still treating patients as he was trying to get clarity as to what the details of the administrative suspension were. So that said, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor of adopting a finding of fact of him, Dr. Greer, practicing while on administrative suspension, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? Okay. There are none. So the motion will carry. And so now that we've adopted all of our findings of fact, let's go ahead and do our conclusions of law. And so what we need are specific statutes and rules that apply to what we've adopted as findings of fact. So maybe we do have a little bit of overlap, right? Like we've got the treating all administrative suspension. We also have failing to comply with the subpoena. Will anyone like to make a motion to adopt findings of fact and state those specific conclusions?
Yes, this is Dr. Knopf. I'll make the motion to adopt the conclusions of law as follows. This might take me a little bit of time. ARS 32924A5 for unprofessional or dishonorable conduct of character likely to deceive or defraud the public. AAC R47902 failing to timely comply with a board subpoena pursuant to ARS 32-929.
Dr. Knopf, that would be number 14.
Yes, thank you. Number 14. ARS 32-3208D, health professional who does not comply with notification requirements, commits an act of unprofessional conduct.
Which one was that again?
It is ARS 32-3208D.
General health statute.
failing to notify if you're charged with a crime.
Okay, I'll strike that one. Thank you.
Okay. Year two. Address.
Are we talking about the failure to update the address?
Yes.
I believe you're looking for 32923A. Every person who is licensed shall notify the board in writing of any address change and telephone number within 30 days.
Yes, that's on. Thank you, Justin. Thank you.
So you probably want to link that in with violating a statute, though.
It would be 16.
Which allegation is this regarding right now?
Noncompliance with the board subpoena, allegation 4 on 013.
Yeah, so if you link that to ARA 32924A16, violating directly or indirectly.
Yeah, we'll link that to ARA 32-924A16. Thank you.
Okay. And then did we go through the unprofessional conduct allegation?
We had, yes, unprofessional conduct listed. I think there's going to be some crossover here, so. That covers my motion for 013.
Were we doing them?
We're trying to do all of them together. So moving to 001 allegations, I need to just review those quickly. So for allegation 5 on 001, conclusion of law would be AAC R479025, failing to create an adequate patient record that includes patient health history, clinical impression, et cetera.
What about making false statements under allegation number 4?
We did not have allegation number 4
okay. In
the motion.
So your last one, Dr. Kernoff, was failing to maintain records?
Correct. Yep.
Failing to create an adequate record?
Yes.
Okay, so
AAC R479025.
02, subsection 5, and then that would also be linked to ARS 32924A5.
Correct. Unprofessional conduct. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're also the breach of doctor-patient confidentiality, or did you cover that in your prior motion? Allegation 1.
Allegation 1 would have been under unprofessional or dishonorable conduct, ARS 32924A5.
And what rule would you want to associate that with? That you can't stand alone. There is a rule that...
There's 9022. No, that's...
902, subsection 36, violating any federal or state statute or rule or regulation, applicable to chiropractic, you could tie it into a HIPAA.
Yep. Violation. That would be the appropriate one. Thank you.
I apologize. I have an emergency real quickly. Can I go? I'll be right back in 2 minutes. Is that okay? I'm having an emergency.
Dr. Greer, we're if you want to leave, you can for 2 minutes, but
I apologize.
This is not the time for us to get input from you. So go ahead and do what you need to do. Did you need clarification on that? Okay. All right.
And then I think that covers all of them between the three at this point for the allegations.
Practicing without the
lawyer. So that would be unprofessional conduct, dishonorable conduct. And I think the other one is
A16.
Yes, correct.
That's relating to practicing while on a suspended license.
Right.
Okay.
I think that's all of them.
All the I's dotted, all the T's crossed. Can you please just summarize that briefly?
Have it all written down.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to call for the question to see if those conclusions of law are agreeable to all of our board members. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Are there any opposed? Okay. Is there a second? Okay, so
second.
Powell seconded. And okay, so the ayes, I'll call for the question again just to be clear. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Okay, any opposed? Okay, hearing none, the ayes have it, and we've adopted our findings of fact and conclusions of law. And so now this is the point where we can decide what we're going to do in this case. So Dr. Bennett expressed some concerns that he thought maybe some type of monitoring. There can be record audits if you think it's appropriate. There can be penalties that are assessed for the violations. You have a litany of things to do. You just cannot revoke a license today because that would be in a formal hearing.
Mr. Chairman, I to begin dialogue and on this subject, I believe that there was knowing negligence in this case, and I believe that we should consider a civil penalty of $1,000 for the two allegations that relate to knowingly practicing without a license and the HIPAA violation. I also recommend that we have a period of probation. And I would like to discuss what our options are with regard to just monitoring this doctor's progress and function levels during a period of like a year.
Okay, so there is a device called the Special Purposes Exam for the National Board. That's more of a clinical competency exam. Are you thinking along those lines, or are you thinking in a different direction? Are you thinking of a fitness to practice evaluation, or what do you suggest?
Yeah, yes, I think that a more global behavioral monitoring versus my conflict here, as I said, is that I see really very well established patient records, the kind that you like to see in practice, but there's such an inconsistency with Dr. Greer's cogency relative to the overall management of this issue and repeated errors and the confusion about things that he should not be confused about. And so my concern is that there may be some kind of condition that we need to be watching for. And maybe there isn't, but I'm expressing a concern and hoping that there's a way that there's a tool we can use.
Mr. Chairman, the board could consider a practice monitor or some sort of quarterly review of records or some sort of evaluation in that aspect if the board would like to consider that.
What do you think about that, Dr. Bennett?
I like the idea of a practice monitor. I don't know what the dosage would be. The titration, I think, should be more spread out over a period of time rather than, fairly intense routine and then letting it go. So maybe quarterly monitors over a 1 year period.
Okay. Ms. Powell, any thoughts?
Quarterly monitor. So someone who'd have to be in the office with him all the time. Is that what you mean by monitoring, Dr. Bennett?
For a specified period of time, like a day.
One day a week?
No. I'm saying four of them. Once a year, okay. every 3 months.
Board members, Dr. Bennett, just for clarification, it sounds like you're discussing an audit of his records every quarter.
I'm not concerned. That's no. Yes. I'll just say simply yes.
So that would be totally different, an audit as opposed to monitoring a doctor's clinical practice.
Well, so I guess maybe I need some clarity on what a monitor really is. What bandwidth do we have in terms of the type of monitoring? Because as I said, candidly, I think his records are very good. I'm just concerned about his global decision-making capabilities in managing the day-to-day process of operating a clinic and the confusion connected with it.
Dr. Guarino, Dr. Bennett, the board has used in the past a monitoring company, and you can set up the parameters in which you want an individual to be reviewed, and you can set up an evaluation rather than an audit in which they're speaking with the doctor, observing their clinical practice ability. And if you, as you specified, one day in a quarter over the course of the year, that is something that is possible. That is different than a record keeping audit.
And I think that's what you mean, right, Dr. Bennett?
Yes, exactly. That sounds like what I think I would feel comfortable pursuing.
Okay, now we're clear.
Okay. And then, so Ms. Powell, do you have any other concerns continuing education you might recommend or anything that you think?
My concerns were more with financial matters, making sure that the doctor is conveying to the patient what their actual fees are so there's no misunderstanding about finances. I don't know that there's a class he can take on that.
Yeah.
So I would just want it in the record that Dr. Gear needs to make clear his financial policies with patients. And I'm not as concerned as Dr. Bennett about the monitoring at all.
Dr. Knopf?
Yeah, I think I'm right in between Dr. Bennett and Ms. Powell. My biggest concerns are just setting up the right communication path so we can avoid this kind of confusion going forward. I'm in agreement with the fine that was suggested by Dr. Bennett. I think there was just some bad business or misrunning of the business. So I'm with Ms. Powell that I don't believe a monitor is necessarily needed in this case. But I do think the fine for not responding to subpoenas, not correctly setting up the address, as well as addressing the HIPAA issue is appropriate.
And as I read through the case, I was in agreement with that. You know, I thought there should be we have a maximum $1,000 civil penalty we can assess for failing to comply with the subpoena, for failing to notify us of the address change as statutorily compelled to do. But I also thought that if possible, he should pay for the cost of the investigation for putting us through this over the last 2 years, and our staff and, Mr. Bohal, that's something we've done in the past.
We have collected restitution for the board's investigation at this level before.
So, is there a statute that allows us to do that?
Yeah.
Okay, so we can assess civil penalties, but that's it. Nobody requested restitution.
Yes, there is. But they didn't request.
Okay. So we're talking about somebody making a motion to the effect of a probationary period between 1 and 2 years, with or without the potential to have early termination if some type of quarterly monitoring is applied, and then penalties that go with that. Someone want to make that motion?
Board Chair, members of the board, if you are going to make a motion for a monitor, you're also going to want to make a motion to have that monitor transmit the records every quarter.
Quarterly report. Board approved monitor that would report back to us.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, before making that motion, I would like to query my fellow board members with regard to their appetite for that particular stipulation. I threw it up for discussion. I don't feel that strongly about it. I just feel there's some need to discuss it and consider it.
I think I've expressed how I feel about the monitor. I don't think it's important. Not something I would say to a motion.
I don't know if that's the right tool to evaluate the concerns, but I did have the same concerns, and I can't think of a better tool. You know, it seemed like Dr. Greer was not very collected with some of his testimony and with the materials that he submitted and the way that he submitted them and with the different conversations that we've had. And so I don't know how that spills into his practice or not. But it is peculiar that you could see a set of records put together so well when we've seen the opposite in person. So I share the concern. I just don't know if that's the way to do it.
Dr. Greeno, on 2020-013, the complainant did request restitution.
Oh, they did.
Thank you, Ms. Kennell.
Okay.
And Jamie, you did find, you do have a statute separate from where the sanctions are listed that you can order restitution.
Hearing correct.
Yeah, it's a little vague on whether it's after a formal interview for a formal hearing, so let's go with Jackie.
And I'm sorry, so that was case 2020-013. Okay, so that was the one where there was a care credit $500 purchase that was made, and the patient purchased a block of treatment and only came in for maybe 5 or 6 of maybe more than 20. And then once she felt like she couldn't come back to the office because her appointment got canceled because she was late, she wanted a refund of some type. And so the patient was left with a credit on their account, care credit, just to put it in context. So.
Also on 2021-001, the patient requested restitution.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Yes, Dr. Bennett.
Does the request for reparations relate to any of the findings of fact that we concluded?
Regarding the, when they request restitution, are they just requesting a dollar amount that they're related to their treatment balance, or does it relate to the allegations that and findings of fact?
Yeah, it's just talking to Seamus. Restitution needs to be making them whole for either you found the treatment was not done properly, maybe in the case, you know, if somebody paid in advance for something and didn't get services for that, you could have ordered that refunded, but it wouldn't relate to noncompliance with a subpoena or practicing on a suspended license. Specifically related to the patient and particular treatment.
So can it be above and beyond what they felt like they were owed? Yeah,
that would be damages.
Okay.
That's sort of why I asked.
New to me. I've only been doing this for 10 years. Dr. Bennett?
So if we have no finding of fact that relates to reimbursing the patient that we agree with, then it feels like it would be inappropriate, or we're constrained from acting upon that if we have no finding of fact relative to it. Am I wrong about that?
Correct. You're right about that.
So was there a finding of fact relative to that? Because I don't think there was one. I don't recall there having been one.
I don't believe so either.
Okay.
So we're not. So we're taking restitution off the table. But you can still order a civil penalty, correct? For violations. Okay.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
So will anyone like to make some decisive action?
Dr. Knopf, I'll make the motion for 1 year probation and a $1,000 fine, which is inclusive of the $50 required fine for non-notice of address change.
So $1,000 total.
Correct.
So 950 plus 50.
Right. Okay. And 1 year probation. No, that would be it. No early. No.
Is that it?
That would be it.
Second.
Is there a second?
Mine. Second.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, I'm going to call for the question, and this is a roll call vote because it's disciplinary action.
One point of clarification, is there a time frame in which you want the civil penalty paid within a year or within 6 months?
Yeah, we'll make it within the probationary year.
Is that a friendly to the second?
Yes.
Okay.
Ms. Powell.
Yes.
Dr. Knopf.
Aye.
Dr. Bennett.
Yes.
Dr. Greeno.
Aye. Okay, so we're all in favor, and the motion will carry. So, Dr. Greer, the board has voted to put you on a probationary status for a year with terms that you must comply with. At the end of the probationary period, you will have to request to be off of your probationary status. There's a fine associated with that. The order that you're going to receive is going to explain your rights to appeal in the event that you choose to challenge the board's decision today. Your time to appeal does not begin to run until the documents are mailed to you. If you have any questions, you can call the board's interim executive director. He'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Just don't call him today because he's very busy today. Thank you very much. And this concludes our formal interview for today. So Dr. Greer, we're done for today. You can call board staff if you need any clarification tomorrow or another day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you want to go to tab 13 to deal with the reinstatement or deal with it later?
Dr. Greer, right. We've got you on tab yes. number 13, so we're going to take that before we go on a short break.
Yes.
So tab number 13 is a matter of reinstatement, which we discussed a little bit earlier today. Mr. Bohal, can you give us a update?
Yes. I'm pulling up my memo right now. The board met on May 26, 2021 and reviewed the potential complaint regarding Joseph Greer, D.C., the allegations that where Dr. Greer was practicing on a suspended license. The board voted to open a case, combine it with two pending complaints, and forward all three to formal interview. The board also directed Dr. Greer to work with staff on reinstating his license by providing board staff with any documentation regarding his renewals for calendar year 2021 and 2020, as well as pay any outstanding fee. Staff received those documentations. We've received the renewal on license on June 7th. In confirmation with the board's chairman, staff processed that renewal and reinstated the license to active status. Staff is asking that the board ratify the reinstatement and the renewal of Dr. Greer's license. We included the renewal for a review as well as his documentation regarding his continuing education for those 2 years.
Okay, so board members, if you're in agreement with the materials in front of you, you can make a motion to ratify the reinstatement. Have questions?
I'll make the motion to ratify.
I'll second.
Okay, second by Dr. Kanoff. Any further discussion? Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Are there any opposed? Okay, we have four ayes in favor of reinstatement and ratification of the reinstatement. So thank you very much, Dr. Greer.
And, thank you.
So the time now is 10:32. If anybody needs to take a quick 10-minute break, now is your chance, and we'll be back about 10:42. Okay, the time is 10:42. We are back in open session. Dr. Bennett, you're with us?
I am.
Okay. Let us go to tab number 2 under whether to open. Matter of Dr. Jason Foster, or not doctor, myopractor. Jason, are you with us today? Jason Foster, not here in person. Anybody signed in as Jason Foster in our virtual meeting? Okay, under the weather to open tab, you are not compelled to show up, so I'm not entirely surprised that he's not here. Mr. Bohal, can I get a board brief?
We received an online complaint on April 29th, 2021. The complainant wishes to remain anonymous. The complaint alleges that a patient was treated by Jason Foster using myopractic techniques. Mr. Foster is not a licensee of the board, so the board would need to review the information that was provided and determine if treatment was within the scope of chiropractic, and then determine if the board would like to take action. One of the routes would be to request additional information from Mr. Foster, and also determine if he's licensed by any of the other agencies, maybe particularly massage therapy, physical therapy, or osteopathic.
And that was my thought. I was wondering if, are we dealing with somebody who maybe was a licensed healthcare professional of any type in the past, and now they are not, and they're just holding themselves out as a myopractor. So board members, what is your thoughts on this? Anyone? Dr. Knopf is ready to say something, but he's muted.
Yeah, it sounds like there's some due diligence on our part to try and investigate this as best we can. So if we've not already, I think we need to look to see, to your point, if there's any licensure that the individual does hold, and what that may look like. And beyond that, I don't know if we can request any records or documentation. It's not patient records if they're not licensed professional. Beyond what we have from the anonymous complaint, it does sound, at least through the complaint, it sounds like he was trying to diagnose headaches, which would definitely be out of scope if not licensed. So I don't know what kind of investigation or what amount of investigation we need to have here and pass it along.
You could direct staff to obtain whatever is available and bring that back before you to make a determination. And in the meantime, we can review and see if they're licensed by any other boards or previously licensed by any other boards. And if it's determined that they are licensed or previously licensed, you can direct staff to forward the complaint to them.
Dr. Bennett, any questions, thoughts?
Yes, Dr. Knopf articulated my thoughts and my confusion quite aptly, and I'm happy to hear that information from staff. The only question that remains for me is, what is our legal jurisdiction here? And I would direct this to our AG staff. What level of jurisdictional authority do we have when it comes to are we able to do things like subpoena patient records to see what's actually going on in the patient encounter on someone who is not a licensed DC? That's my question.
And in order, and there's several components to that. Within that is the board authority disorder, that shall encourage the county to bring in general's office. You also have injunctions. But before you begin to do any of those steps, I think gather some information. It requires verify. But I think that people all said right now you probably don't have enough. I would see this. But so the answer to your question is also.
The answer to your question is that you do have jurisdiction over unlicensed practitioners.
So, if I'm reading this right, because we don't know what kind of documentation, if any, exists either with this individual or any of the people that were seeking services here, if we look at item number, was it to retain all records of the complaint and documentation verification for at least 10 years, I know that that could potentially be a lot of documentation, but would that cover any client services that were provided by that individual?
You know, you're speaking of, I think this refers to what the board's requirement is, that you retain whatever records you receive.
Yeah, so would the request back to Mr. Foster just say, look, we need documents?
Yes, I think you have the authority to issue the request. Whether or not you're going to get anything is, you know, a different story. But, you know, a lot of times with these, if you do decide, based on what information you get back from your staff, if you do decide to open it, a lot of times a letter is the first step to the individual to say, you know, we have this information, please tell us what you're doing. But I think you're all right that maybe you just don't have enough right now.
And so this isn't somebody who's advertising chiropractic services. And so I think that is a point of importance, because if it were somebody who was unlicensed, that would be a much easier path. So would we send out a letter requesting information, but that's not a subpoena that compels them to send anything to us because they're not a licensed chiropractor?
Right. It's a letter, and Okay. Sometimes they respond, sometimes they don't.
But then my understanding is that we've attempted to investigate, and at that point we can pass it on.
Right.
Okay.
So that should be the step then. We just find out if they're licensed, what license they have, if they have one, and then make a decision about whether to forward to the AG.
Okay. So I'd like to direct staff to continue to get more information and reach out to this person and find out they are, in fact, holding themselves out in any way as a chiropractor. Let's go on to tab number 3, matter of Dr. David Slobodnik. Dr. Slobodnik, are you present? If you are, it is time to go ahead and unmute yourself. Okay, Mr. Bohol.
Board staff received an anonymous complaint. The complainant alleges that Dr. Slobodnik was suggesting ways in which they could obtain more money for their treatment through their personal injury case. Staff has attempted to have the patient and the complainant remove their request to be anonymous so that we can request the patient records. The board can direct staff to gain any of the personal patient records based on the information that we provided through the doctor if the board would like to open the complaint and proceed to get more information from the physician.
Okay, so board members, even though the complainant is anonymous, we can still subpoena records and get more information on this one if you think that there's something we need to investigate.
I think that, Mr. Chairman, this is Dr. Bennett, I think that the allegation of failure to release records opens the door makes action on our part mandatory, and that would give us afford us the opportunity to then request records and look and see if there's any relevance to some of the other allegations that are being considered.
Okay. Would you like to make a motion?
Yes, I would make a motion to that effect, that we move forward with opening a complaint. Can we use all four of the potential allegations in this case, or should we just be confined to one? I think it would be more expedient to broaden the scope of our initial investigation rather than wait for evidence to then have to do it later.
No, you can do all four.
Okay, then I would make a motion that we open a complaint based on all four allegations.
Okay, is there a second?
A second.
Yeah, Dr. Knopf beat Ms. Powell by a half second on the second. So I will call for the question. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Four ayes have it. We will open a complaint. And let's go on now to Dr. Lawrence Paul, D.C., tab number four. Dr. Paul, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Hi, come on up. Have a seat. You'll need to toggle the microphone, and it will go from red to green. You'll be unmuted, and you'll have the ability to introduce yourself to our recorded record.
Where? Oh, there it is. Okay.
Hi. Your name, please.
My name is Lawrence David Paul.
Hi, welcome. Mr. Bohal, will you please give us a board brief?
Board staff received an anonymous complaint. The complainant alleges that Dr. Pauly is not performing examinations that are appropriate or adequate for the FMCSA standards, which is the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, and this would be for the Department of Transportation examinations. The complainant alleges that Dr. Pauly did not request supporting documentation for a patient's management of their condition, including type 2 diabetes or myocardial infarctions. That is all the information that we have right now.
Okay. Is it Pauly or Paul?
Paul.
Paul. Okay, great. What do you have to say for yourself regarding those allegations?
Yes, well, I have the privilege of being able to do DOT and CDL exams. That's Department of Transportation. And the certified driver license physical exams for the FMCSA. To be able to do that, you have to take a class and then take a test and be appointed, and chiropractors are one of the groups of people that are able to participate in that. I have been performing these exams this is my 21st year of doing that in the official capacity since 2013 when they started the ruling when you have to be certified to do that. We have many DOT exams that we perform in the office. There is a protocol. Sometimes the patients are not truthful on the examination and we are not aware that they have certain conditions. That's an issue. With regards to requesting documentation, it is to the discretion of the examiner to obtain additional documentation to make a decision whether that driver is able to perform the duties of a DOT or CDL driver.
So the complainant is saying that you are basically either withholding information or certifying drivers that should not be certified. What do you say to that?
Well, I disagree. I pay careful attention to the interview and to the exam as to if that person is able to drive, and I only certify people who I believe are able to physically drive, the CDL and DOT.
Okay. Ms. Powell, do you have any questions?
Yes. In the complaint, there's some very specific allegations. Are you saying none of those are true, any of them true? Do you think you've become more lax over the years in certifying people?
I think I give each person individual attention and individual decision as to whether they're able to drive. I believe they're able to physically drive.
So you're going based on what the patient tells you?
Yes.
You ever request additional records? If they put on their history that they see an endocrinologist, for example, do you ask for those records?
Yes, we have. Mm-hmm.
You have? Do you do it routinely?
Yes.
Okay. No further questions.
Dr. Knopf?
Yes, doctor. As of right now, with FMCSA, are you under any kind of investigation, probationary status, or
no,
anything with that group?
No, I received any documentation or inquiries whatsoever from them.
Or from the DOT? Or
no.
Okay. One of the specific allegations made is around a patient with vision loss. It was found that the patient had 20/100 vision in the left eye. They're stating that you need to be able to obtain 20/40 minimally bilaterally to be certified. Do you have any response to an allegation with any patients that you might be overlooking any of these kind of symptoms or signs during the examination that Ms. Powell was alluding to?
Well, everybody gets tested, including vision. There is something called, there is a procedure with the DOT that person can get a waiver or an exemption, special paperwork that's filled out. And it's also noted on the medical examination report that person would need a waiver or exemption. It would be stated as part of the paperwork, the way the paperwork is filled out. There is space for that, and it should be provided on that paperwork.
So you're saying that someone might have this condition, but there are certain times where they're exempt from this requirement. What are those times where they might have an exemption?
Okay, actually, the language says waiver versus exemption. The waiver is a intrastate issue, so only within the state of Arizona. Exemption is a federal issue.
Okay. So then what are the cases that either one might apply to a patient with deteriorated vision? That doesn't
anybody who did not meet the standard of at least 20/40 would require either a Arizona interstate waiver or a federal exemption.
And what would be the reason for a waiver or an exemption?
They would not be able to meet the standard of 20/40 in either or both eyes.
Maybe I'm not saying it. I understand that they've got a deficiency, but why would either the state or federal agency allow an exemption for these individuals?
Well, first of all, they must go to an optometrist or ophthalmologist to have paperwork filled out. They would bring that paperwork to the DOT office, and it would be processed. And if they're given a waiver, then they are allowed to drive. They're allowed to drive for 1 year at a time between the physical examinations, and they must remain in the state of Arizona. That's for a Arizona interstate waiver. If it is a federal exemption, they're actually allowed to drive from state to state.
Okay. So from your perspective, as someone performing the exam, you wouldn't know why they got an exemption or a waiver. You would just see that would have been on their record that was provided to them, which would then allow you to pass them to be able to drive. Is that correct?
Not exactly, because they could come to us without an exemption or a waiver. We would simply note it on the medical report.
All the questions I have. Thank you.
Dr. Bennett, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. Thank you. Dr. Paul, hi. Dr. Bennett. Dr. Paul, we have been certified with FMCA in our clinics for quite some number of years, and so I think I can speak to this issue fairly well. And I agree with you that a significant amount of discretion is left to the examiner, but not total discretion. And in cases where there are some gray area, we are provided with the opportunity to kind of share that evaluation process with whatever particular provider it applies to. For example, if someone had blood pressure that needed to be controlled, we could give them a time frame and refer them to a cardiologist and have the cardiologist control the blood pressure and get us a letter back and so forth. Is that consistent with your understanding of things?
Yes.
Okay, and is that how you are accustomed to practicing in your clinic?
Depends. Many times I've given a 1 month or a 3 month or a 6 month or a 1 year. The standard, of course, would be 2 years, but many, many times I've given less than the 2 years, even less than the 1 year, to allow the person to be in compliance with their blood pressure, diabetes, or et cetera.
Okay, so let me reapproach this question a little bit differently. Are there occasions when you have the patient evaluated, if you feel as though you are not a cardiologist and you can't properly assess a patient who has a cardiac risk factor or a history, you know, and a cancer or a vision issue or what have you, in those cases, when it's a borderline situation, are you then, do you have a procedure in your practice where you have that driver see another provider who then certifies that they, as a cardiologist or what have you, authorized and cleared the driver to pass that component? Is that something that you do in your clinic?
Yes.
Okay. So if we were to, and I think we should, if we were to subpoena some of these records on these patients where we see cases that appear rather egregious, and they could or could not be, but if we looked at those records, then we would see the documentation of those kinds of things happening, would we not?
Right.
Okay. And just to confirm, you're not aware of any kind of quality assurance endeavor reviewing your records or evaluating your records being performed at this time by the FMCSA or any federal related entity?
No, I've not received any notification from anybody.
Okay, thank you. I have no further questions. I think we should open the case and subpoena the records.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and make a motion then.
I move that we open the case and subpoena the records.
Okay, so I think we need to be maybe specific about what records, and so that we don't end up with too many records. So what can be the best way to go about this?
I was afraid you were going to answer that.
Dr. Greeno, Dr. Bennett, I may have a suggestion if the board would like. The board could request a list of all the patients from Dr. Paul that maybe have specific conditions. What was listed in the complaint was type 2 diabetes and the history of a heart condition. Then staff could obtain that list and narrow down and maybe do a sampling of cases or compare and see what cases what case files may be necessary to review or subpoena.
Okay.
Dr. Bennett?
That's information. The only thing, and I'm not sure about this, but the only thing that would make it even more reliable would be to cross the records with the patient specifically named in the complaint.
Well, we have initials, right? We don't have full names.
Correct.
And I don't think we have birth dates or any other way to match.
We could do our best to try to match those.
Okay.
Okay. My motion then would be to open complaints on all allegations and instruct staff to identify at-risk driver populations and subpoena a sampling of those for board review.
Okay, is there a second?
Second the motion.
All seconds. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Are there any opposed? Okay. Hearing none, the ayes have it, and the motion carries. Let us go on to the next tab regarding Dr. Robert Martin, tab number 5. Thank you, Dr. Paul.
Board staff received an anonymous complaint on May 5th, 2021. The complainant alleges that Dr. Bob or Robert Martin is advertising or implying that he is practicing in Arizona without a license. You do not have a current licensee that has an active license in Arizona. We do have a Robert Martin license number 939 that is listed as inactive. The complainant also alleges that Dr. Martin, through his radio show, makes allegations of, I think the phrase was, and I'm trying to avoid answering or implying anything. I believe that this could be a First Amendment type of situation, but the board can deal with the fact that he may be advertising or implying that he has an active Arizona license and does not.
Okay, thank you. And so is Robert Martin available? He's not here in person today. I don't see him. Is he joining by virtual meeting? Okay, if you are, go ahead and unmute yourself and announce yourself. So when I read through the materials and I looked at the PDF of the doctor's website, he does in fact call himself Dr. Bob Martin. And in the past, you know, the board has seen if any time that a chiropractor puts doctor in front of their name, it's a currently licensed chiropractor, unless they say otherwise, unless they say that they are retired or mention their status, it has landed themselves in a little bit of trouble. So that's the issue I see with this. And then as I read through, he also mentions that he's a nutrition expert, and we have rule 47.901.3 that says we cannot advertise that we are experts. And he also mentions that he's board certified, that he's a board certified chiropractic physician and physiotherapist in Arizona, Colorado, and Kentucky. Well, we don't offer board certifications as a chiropractic physician. We offer certifications in our specialties, but you cannot say you're a board certified modalities person. You can say you're certified by the board, and there's a difference. So he's using the term physiotherapy, which we don't use anymore anyway. So I think we've got several grounds here to open up a complaint, but I would like to entertain your thoughts, Dr. Knopf.
I agree, and I think the only thing that I would add is maybe there's a responsibility to pass it to the Colorado board and Kentucky board as well for the other two states that he's alleging that he's licensed in. Just for them to do a check as well.
Right. And he can mention his opinions on vaccinations any way that he wants. I don't see that as the issue here. I see it more as an advertising issue. Ms. Powell?
I agree.
Okay.
And I agree with Dr. Knopf. We should forward this on to the Colorado and Kentucky boards as well.
Dr. Bennett, any comments?
Agreed on all points.
Okay. Someone like to make a motion to open?
Make the motion to open the complaint as well as forward the complaint to the state boards of Colorado and Kentucky as well.
And that's going to be based on which allegations?
This will actually be...
I'm not sure if the first allegation addresses this matter appropriately.
Would we be able to...
It's almost because he's not licensed. You're really doing an unlicensed investigation. He's not a licensed chiropractor. I don't know that you need to identify any of those.
So just be first
really related
to investigate.
To his advertising as a
chiropractor. Yeah. And then appropriate advertising if licensed.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Hearing none, the ayes have it. And we'll move on to tab number 6, which is regarding Adrian Marnelli, DC. Marnell?
Marnell.
Adrian, are you present? I'm calling out to the virtual meeting. Adrian Marnell, if you are present, now is the time to go ahead and unmute yourself so we can... your matter before us. Mr. Bohal.
Complainant filed a complaint with the board. stating that she was looking for an animal chiropractor. She ran across an advertisement from an Adrian Marnell advertising animal chiropractic. She reviewed him on the board's website and determined that his license was revoked. And she also looked him up on the American Veterinary Chiropractic Association's website. And he's not currently certified by them. So she's forwarding the complaint for the board for allegations of practicing animal chiropractic while unlicensed. The board would like to open the complaint and address the fact that Mr. Marnell was a chiropractor that was revoked by the board and now is seeming to perform animal chiropractic.
And board members, you have additional materials in your packet, which is a statement from Adrian Marnell describing a little bit of why he's not here right now and his position on this. And some legislation that was introduced but never really went anywhere, HB 2215. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Ms. Powell.
I'm not sure that any of that will matter because unless he has his chiropractic license, he can't have his veterinarian license. The certification becomes invalid. He needs to renew that. I think it's every couple of years. Pass the test. Just let it lapse. But we can't even go there. He doesn't have it. He's not licensed or certified to treat animals based on the fact that he doesn't have a chiropractic license. And that's according to the AVC.
Okay, so we have an unlicensed chiropractor advertising some type of chiropractic services?
Yes.
Okay, what do we want to do with that?
Make a motion to open, investigate.
Okay.
I'll second.
Okay, any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, I'll call for the question. Those in favor of opening the complaint signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Are there any opposed? Okay. The ayes have it, and the complaint will be open, and we'll move on to tab number 7. Dr. Petula Gillingham.
I believe.
Hi. Come on up. Go ahead and unmute the microphone and introduce yourself for the record, please. There you go.
Good morning.
Hi. What is your name?
Chula Gillingham.
Hi. Thanks for joining us. Mr. Bohal?
Yes. The board received a complaint from the American Specialty Health Group Network that Dr. Gillingham was reported to the National Practitioner Databank. Pulling up the information here. ASH, or American Specialty Health, issued Dr. Gillingham a corrective action plan and then noted that Dr. Gillingham was not compliant with their program and then terminated her clinical privileges and reported that to National Practitioner Databank.
Hi, what would you like to say to the allegations?
Well, I didn't know I was going to get a chance to say anything, so this was real quick putting together, but basically when ASH came into Arizona in 2012, I started following the protocols of filling out the paperwork on every patient, most often on every patient visit. And over the years, I got to the top tier in ASHN. 2 years ago, I hit the top tier. That following year, they requested different records, and they gave me a corrective action plan, which I followed. I did their corrective action plan. I did a couple of classes that they wanted me to do, and they allowed me to continue, but they dropped me all the way back down to the first tier. Which, if anybody knows with ASHN, with the first tier, you are not allowed to do an adjustment. The only thing you're allowed to do is an exam, which for me, as a chiropractor, was ludicrous. But, you know, I did exam, and then basically I'd have to tell patients that, you know, none of their adjustments are going to be covered, so it's going to be a cash fee if they want to see me. And some did, some didn't. And then a year later, ASH requested records again, and they issued me another corrective action plan. At that point, in the corrective action plan, they told me that if I want to continue to participate in their network, that I would have to do the corrective action plan. I chose that I didn't want to participate in their network anymore, so I didn't do the corrective action plan. And everywhere in the 24 pages that I read, not once did they say, that this was malpractice, this was anything other than I would now not be allowed to practice in their insurance program, which I didn't want to anyway, so I was like, yay. So that's where it was. I didn't realize it was going to go to this point, but that's the reason why I did not follow through with that.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to ask my board members if they have any questions for you.
Sure.
And then is the complainant not here today? Okay, Dr. Knopf.
I don't have any questions.
Paul.
No questions.
Dr. Bennett?
This is Dr. Wayne Bennett. Dr. Gillingham, are you currently practicing?
I am.
All right. And I guess my concern would be, we're all familiar with American Specialties Health Network. We're all familiar with their tier programs, the record-keeping dictates, and so forth. Our concern here is, in responding to this, that your records meet the proper standard with regard to all of healthcare, not the guidelines of a third-party administrator. But for that reason, I feel like an obligation based upon this report to at least open a complaint and take a sampling of recent records just to make sure that we're good with this provider. And that's the motion I would make.
Okay. And so do we need more clarification on that, or are we?
I guess with regard to identifying, maybe identifying the records of a random sampling of 10 patients' treatment records, 10 different, some of which would include E&M, some of not, all within the last 30 days.
Okay. Is there a second? No second? Okay. So your motion fails. Anybody else want to make a different motion?
This is Dr. Knopf. I would make the motion that we do not open this complaint.
I'll second the motion.
Okay, so take no action. Okay. Those in favor, or any continued discussion? We have a first and second to not open. Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Okay, Dr. Bennett is opposed. The three ayes carry the motion to take no action. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, tab number 8 is whether to open regarding Dr. Michael Papamathicus. Papamathicus. Hi.
Good morning. I'm an attorney for Dr. Mike.
Go ahead and unmute the mic and introduce yourself for the record. Make yourself at home. You gotta give it a good push. There you go.
I represent Dr. Papamathicus, who I call Dr. Mike, here today. We asked the board to...
What is your name, sir?
Sorry, I'm Greg Collins with Kirschmar,
Arizona.
I'm licensed in Arizona. Matt Kirschmar, Feltus and Collins, typically practice intellectual property litigation and am involved in a lawsuit where we represent Collision Chiropractic, which is the doctor's company, against a former chiropractor, which I believe that this complaint against him likely arises from. We asked the board to continue this hearing out a month. The doctor has been in Greece since about July 7, July 8, and will be returning from Greece Friday. So we had asked that this be moved out a little bit. With it out, the board decided to move forward today, or we were told it wouldn't be moved. I'm appearing therefore on behalf of the doctor because we were asked to. The doctor is taking these allegations very seriously. His brother George is attending the today with me, and I have Sarah Humble from my office.
All right, thank you. Mr. Bohal, would you like to give us a board briefing?
Yes. Complainant alleges that Dr. Papamathicus attempted to negotiate a fee that had been reduced by an attorney through a personal injury case with another provider. Complainant provided the recorded telephone call for the board's review. And the board can determine if it'd like to open a complaint for additional information and investigation, or if the board would like to take no action tonight.
Okay. And is the complainant present by chance?
No one has signed in to speak.
Okay. All right. So we're under the tab of whether to open a complaint or not. And so I'm going to ask my board members, given the information that they have, if we were to open a complaint, it would just continue the investigation. The doctor would have a chance to come back and explain himself if that were the case. The fact that he's not here today, he's not compelled to be here today. It's okay that he's in Greece or wherever he is right now.
He asked me to make a short statement to indicate that there is no violation of rule 479.02.34 here. There is no referral fee paid. There is no splitting of fees paid. The allegation here, which I hadn't been provided prior to showing up at this hearing, likely arises from documents that were produced in a lawsuit against Dr. Quackenbush. Dr. Quackenbush is involved in using the Collision Chiropractic name to drive patients to his practice as away from Dr. Mike, and he is being sued in Arizona Federal District Court for that conduct. We don't believe there's any basis to institute an investigation at this point, given the anonymous nature of the accusation. If the board believes otherwise, the doctor will absolutely cooperate in any investigation going forward. The allegations as I hear them today are actually a little bit different than I expected them to be as described in the letter that was sent on June 9th.
Okay, I'll leave it at that. Thank you. Board members, do you have any thoughts? Ms. Powell is shaking her head yes.
Yes, I would like to just make a motion that we open the case based on the allegations. There's more than just there's potential criminal behavior here. I think it needs to be investigated.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Board members, any further discussion? Okay. Hearing none, I'm going to call for the question. Those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? Okay. The ayes have it. So we're going to open up a complaint, and then Dr. Papamathicus will be briefed on coming back on a future date.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, tab number 9 is a matter of Dr. Stephen Gillen. We offered a consent agreement to Dr. Gillen. Are you present?
Yes, sir, I am.
This is Adam Jaffe, Dr. Gillen's attorney as well, is present.
Hi. How are you, Mr. Jaffe?
Very well, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Bohal, can you please give us a brief?
Yes. In the board meeting in January, the board directed to offer a consent agreement to Dr. Gillen in his matter before the board. The terms included a one-year probation, a requiring continuing education in billing and record keeping that had been pre-approved by the board, and then being subject to one record keeping audit by a board approved designee or auditor, and conducting that in a 1 year time. That consent agreement was drafted and sent to Dr. Gillen and his attorney. They have responded and requested that the board modify and offer a different consent agreement. That letter was received on May 11th, 2021, and is in the board file for review. And of course, they're now present to discuss that with you. So the board can reaffirm the offer of the consent agreement. If that consent agreement is not acceptable to them, the board can move forward to formal interview, or the board can make any modifications to the consent agreement as the board would like.
Okay, Dr. Gillen, I think it's your phone that's making a whole lot of noise. So if you can just maybe mute yourself until it's your turn to speak, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Jaffe, you have something that you'd like to say?
Yes, and I want to be clear, and we made this clear, hopefully in the letter, in that the request for the reconsideration is not any attempt. We're not contesting Dr. Gillen's duty and responsibility to maintain adequate records. He's not contesting the facts. You know, he's been forthright with the board. I think it's important that, and I'll, you know, reiterate this from the letter, and that is that, you know, this matter has been going on for now almost 5 years. And since inception, you know, Dr. Gillen has done everything he can in order to replace his former business partner, replace his staff, billing. So he has done quite a bit, in terms of, demonstrating rehabilitation and remediation. Number two is that, you know, in light of the situation, it was Dr. Gillen that brought these matters to the attention, to the board. And for purposes of public policy, you know, we think, in light of the punishment that, or the offer of probation, which is similar to his ex-business partner, just does not seem equitable. And we simply are asking that in order to encourage people to come forth and to report matters, we would ask that, you know, that probation, in light of all of the items that have occurred, that probation not be instituted. And Dr. Gillen will, of course, comply with continuing education as well as with the audit, because that will demonstrate his remediation and rehabilitation. So I can go through more if need be, but I think unless the board has any particular questions, it's spelled out pretty clear in our letter.
Thank you, Mr. Jaffe. We've read the letter. We've read the proposed consent agreement. I personally think that this is an adequate consent agreement, and I'm going to ask my board members if they want to weigh in. And so, board members, we have the ability to modify this if you think it's appropriate. If it's not signed and agreed to, then we go to formal interview, and then we can take any remedy that we want to. If you think that this consent agreement is not adequate and you want to add more disciplinary measures or less, you know, that would be the time to do it. So I'll start with Dr. Knopf. What are your thoughts on modifying this or keeping it as is and giving them the opportunity to sign it before we move to formal interview?
For me, I'm in the same camp as you are. I believe this is an appropriate consent agreement that was issued. I wouldn't make any changes at this point.
Okay. Dr. Bennett?
I, with everything that's been said, I don't believe that anything has changed that is relevant to the facts, the findings of facts. I don't think we should do anything at this point except what we thought was a good idea in the first place.
Okay, Ms. Powell.
There's some long-reaching effects of putting a doctor on probation, which is any managed care programs that he may be enrolled in. His name gets reported, he gets taken off lists. It hinders, very much hinders his ability to practice. I mean, basically they go cash practice. So I'm not sure where the doctor is and all of that. I tend to be sympathetic with regard to probation. I think he has been through a lot, suffered the consequences. I'm not sure that probation does anything except it's an embarrassment and it will take him out of network for a long time, not just a year. So for that reason, I would consider amending the consent agreement.
Okay, and this is Dr. Guarino, and I'm in favor of the probation, you know, because part of the probationary order was to have continuing education and do a record audit, which will give us an opportunity to see what if any behavior has changed. You know, we've heard testimony in the past regarding Dr. Gillen, you know, not being the person who makes his own soap notes appropriately, not supervising billing. This is our chance to go ahead and see that that's been remedied, and so I'm in favor of it. So, Mr. Jaffe, I'll give you one more chance at the microphone, you or your client, and then when then we're going to make a decision.
Well, like we said, we're not objecting to the audit. We're not objecting to the continuing education. And I think it was clarified that yes, you know, Dr. Gillen does not want to have probation on his record, and I think that you know that was simply the basis of the request for the modification. So, yeah, Dr. Gillen, you want to say anything?
Yeah, I would like to say something to Dr. Bennett and to Dr. Guarino. Being in practice for as long as you guys have been in practice, putting me on probation does hinder what I do moving forward with my career. If we look back, the opposing party is on disability. It doesn't affect him. But more importantly, as people listen to this, I noticed that something was wrong in my clinic. As the board, being the governing body, I made the phone call 5 years ago. So how probation is appropriate in this setting, I would like somebody to go ahead and please explain. We have somebody that was involved with criminal activity. I brought it to the board's attention, and now I'm being punished for taking it to the board. I would also like to add the argument, right? Because the basis of a good argument is to argue both sides equally as well. If I was in your position, my rebuttal would be this. Imagine if I never called. My question would be, Stephen, why did you not call the board and report this immediately? In my opinion, that would be a very, very strong opinion and or argument. But as I sit here in my office working, if you put me on probation, it's on my permanent record. I go in as an expert witness. They're going to look at it. It's going to affect the way I make money. And truthfully, to the board, each and every one of you have been in practice long enough. What did I do wrong? I brought it to your attention per my attorney to separate myself from wrongdoing. And in actuality, I'm getting worse of a penalty than the opposing party. I still have to work in practice. Understand why he's on disability. He basically took the board's power away. I have been nothing but forthcoming, honest. And if we look back at the record, we have people and or lawyers lying under oath. And for the life of me, I'm almost jaded at the way the board has responded to this complaint. You guys are supposed to be here giving me advice and helping me, not punishing me. And this, I think, moving forward, if you do not go back and reconsider the probation, I think that sends a negative message to all of the youthful and young chiros out there that are having a problem in practice, especially coming from Mr. Bennett or Dr. Bennett and Dr. Guarino, being 70 years old, been in practice 29 years. You know in your heart I did the right thing. I had a problem. I called my superiors. And after 5 years, I get the same shake as this criminal that I was in business with. And respectfully, I say that in closing. So I hope that in your hearts, you guys decide to do the right thing, because probation handicaps me on making money. It hurts my career. And truthfully, I don't deserve it. I don't deserve it. I called you guys for advice. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gillen.
Board Chair, members of the board, just for clarification purposes, if you remove the probationary term out of the order, you cannot to then do the audit. You have to have the probationary term in there.
I will go ahead.
All right. So, board members.
Mr. Chairman, you know. May I have the privilege of responding?
Sure, Dr. Bennett.
So Dr. Gillen, I commend you for taking the initiative and doing what you did. You did do the right thing. And for that, I commend you. And my support of you being placed on probation has not a thing to do with that act. One thing is not the other. I will tell you very specifically that the reason why I support being placed on probation is not in any way intended to be a penalization of your coming forward with these allegations. It's what I heard you say while you were sitting before the board in terms of your level of indifference and responsibility relative to record keeping and documentation at the very time that you were speaking to the board. for those reasons, I am completely convinced that it is necessary for the board to see to it that you make the changes in your record keeping protocols that are necessary for the safety of the public.
I'm sorry, Dr. Ben. I'm sorry. I'm not quite understanding what you're saying. Basically.
All right. Hold on. This is Dr. Guarino. We are not here today to get into a big back and forth about this. We are here to decide if we are going to, as a board, make a change to the proposed consent agreement. Right. Dr. Gillen, I don't want to hear any more testimony out of you. We've heard it. I want to know if my board members think that it is time for us to modify this, or we can go to formal interview and then we can make another decision at that point and decide if disciplinary action is appropriate or not at that point. So I'm going to go ahead and see if anybody wants to make a motion.
I move that we move forward with our already made decision.
Okay. There a second?
I'll second.
So the motion is...
What was the already made decision? I apologize.
On the table today was whether we were going to modify the proposed consent agreement, and you're suggesting that we make no modification to the consent agreement, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and so if not signed, we continue to formal interview.
Do you want to put a time limit on how long he has to sign it or not?
Dr. Bennett, do you want to put a time limit on how long he can take to make the decision to sign the proposed consent agreement or not?
I don't know what an appropriate time limit is. If it's appropriate, we should. I would trust him to be forthright and make the decision as soon as possible.
Okay, well, for the sake of time, you know, if you give him a month, he'll have to be noticed at least another month after that to come in for the formal interview. So that would already kick it out 2 months.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Bennett, I would note for the record, standard practice is to offer 30 days to sign the consent agreement.
Okay, then let's do that.
Okay.
If not signed, then move to formal interview.
Is that correct, Dr. Bennett? If not signed, we formal interview as we had already discussed. Okay. So is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, board members, any further discussion? Okay, I'm going to call for the question. Those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay, Ms. Powell is opposed. The three ayes have it. So thank you, Dr. Gillen, Dr. Jaffe. You've heard what the board decided to do. If you have any specific questions, you can call the board staff tomorrow. All right, let's go on to tab number, under licensure, tab number 10. Matter of Dr. Jordan Rash, Shapiro.
Chairman Guarino, members of the board, Dr. Rash submitted an application for licensure by examination and PMMTP certification on April 23rd. Records indicate that Dr. Rash was charged with a DWI on November 14, 2014, to which he pleaded guilty. He paid fines and attended substance abuse classes and serve 2 years of supervised probation.
Okay, and Jordan, are you present?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, welcome. Can you introduce your name for the record, please?
I'm Jordan Ross.
Okay, and would you like to make any comments before the board decides if we will grant you a license?
No, I would not like it.
Okay, board members, do you have any questions for Dr. Rash? Okay, are there any motions to be made?
Dr. Knopf, I'll make the motion to grant licensure upon payment of appropriate fees.
Second.
Okay, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Are there any opposed? Okay, congratulations, Dr. Rash. You'll get a license in Arizona.
Thank you very much.
Okay, tab number 11 is licensure regarding Jamie Lessard. Jamie, are you present?
I am.
Hi, welcome. Introduce your name for the record, please.
Jamie Williams.
Hi, Ms. Shapiro.
Chairman Guarino, members of the board, Dr. Lessard submitted an application for licensure by examination and PMMTP certification on May 10th. Records indicate that Dr. Lessard was charged on September 19th, 1999 with a DWI and other charges. He subsequently failed to attend classes ordered by the court, and his probation was extended 6 months. Dr. Lessard was also charged with DWIs in 2001 twice, and in February of 2015, all to which he pleaded guilty. Dr. Lessard was also charged with disorderly and engaging in an affray in 2005, which was later dismissed. Board staff has concerns for potential future legal issues because Dr. Lessard notes in his letter that he has not complied with the 614-2018 disposition of the DWI that he states he owes monies to the clerk of Wake County Court. If the board wishes to offer a consent agreement for licensure, some terms to consider are a 5-year probation, a compliance monitor, EBAS, AA, urine drug screen analyses, or a provision requiring the applicant to provide evidence that he is in compliance with the terms issued in the court by the court in Wake County.
Okay. So my question is, why do you have outstanding fees from your 2018 DWI with the clerk of Wake County?
I do not. Those fees have been paid, and I did 20 hours of an online counseling. I believe the online counseling was in November of last year. So everything, I am able to go to North Carolina and get a driver's license. Those fees have been paid.
Okay. Does that match what we have on staff?
It's Dr. Lessard's own letter that states that the fees were not paid, and that was legal advice.
Yeah, and that's my fault for not updating that letter. Those documentation from all those courts, those were used when I applied for my Georgia license. And then I have since paid the North Carolina. So I can get you documentation of that. That's not a problem at all. I can email it to the board.
Okay. Board members, do you have any questions for Dr. Lessard?
This is Dr. Knopf. Dr. Lessard, one of the things that we look at when we have people with issues like this is, are these one-offs? Are they happening over and over again? And in this case, sure. It looks like that there's been many reoccurrences of really the same issue. Some spanning as much as 14 years and then occurring again. What kind of assurance do we have if we're providing you with a license in this state that you've effectively corrected for this behavior?
Sure. Well, I mean, I hold a Georgia license. I've held the North Carolina massage certification for 16 years. I've never had anything professionally come into play. It was something where when I moved to the state of North Carolina, I got into the bar business to meet people. Obviously, things went down a wrong road, and it looks habitual. It looks a lot worse on paper than I live my lifestyle. So I'm not here to make excuses. It is what it is. The simple affray was something that I wasn't involved in, so that was dropped. And then the last DWI, I was moving my car from a company party. I had lived in Georgia, went to North Carolina. I was parked on the street on a Thursday night, went to move it into the garage, and the cops had seen us come out of the bar. So it was, that is more of a one-off. So it doesn't mimic my behavior from earlier in 1999 and 2001. But again, professionally, I've never had any issues. On paper, it does look a lot worse than the lifestyle I live. And it's something that, I have to be, I carry that with me, because listening to you guys, read it off, it's still embarrassing to me. So it's something that I carry with me, and I hold that burden. But, there's nothing that I can say, besides my professional aspect of things that should convince you. But my professional license here and my certification that I've held for 16 years in North Carolina, those have never been scarred or tainted by any complaints.
Are you in any current programs, Alcohol Anonymous? Are you doing anything to help yourself, or are you at this point, are you not participating in any classes or ways?
No, I'm not. I did what was required of me. I'm it's not going to sound cliche, but I don't have a dependency with alcohol. I don't typically drink. You know, even in the times when I did get the DWIs, I was working in the bar. So I was usually working, you know, on the weekends. They were just mishaps where, you know, I made bad decisions when I drank. So I don't really drink anymore. I'm getting other certifications to go on top of my schooling with chiropractic. So that keeps me busy. And, you know, I'm new at chiropractic. So I'm busy, you know, trying to build my business and get away from that lifestyle that it used to be.
Thank you. That's all I have for questions.
Yeah. Any other questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Ms. Powell.
Do you drink socially?
Not really. I might have one or two beers. I think the last time I drank was I had two beers at dinner 3 weeks ago about. I don't really go out that much either. I'm a little bit older than a lot of kids coming out of school, so I don't really do the bar scene or the party scene so much anymore.
And what are your plans for practicing in Arizona if you're licensed?
Well, I've been talking to a couple docs there, probably come there as an IC, but eventually want to open my own practice. So I've got a lot of, you know, there's going to be a lot of work being done to build my business because, again, like I said, I'm a little bit behind the eight ball of the kids coming out of school. So I have a lot of quote unquote catching up to do to be where I want to be successful wise and have my own practice.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Bennett.
I have no questions.
Okay. So board members, what's your pleasure? Would you feel comfortable issuing a license or denying or maybe a license with consent agreement?
Mr. Chairman, I would recommend that we agree to grant contingent upon a consent agreement that would include 1 year probation, a compliance monitor, completion of the EBAS, urine drug screenings, and of course we'll want that documentation from the clerk of Wake County Court.
Okay, so take and pass all parts of the EBAS?
Yes.
Do we need
contingent?
What do you mean by compliance?
What kind of a compliance monitor?
Sorry.
What does that mean?
Alcohol cessation compliance.
So like an absent, like a random drug and urine screening?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant somebody to monitor his practice.
No, I mean monitor his drinking.
I don't drink, sir, so.
Well, then it would be easy to monitor.
Okay, so we have a motion on the floor. Is there a second?
Can we clarify the motion, please?
Dr. Bennett, Ms. Powell would like you to clarify the motion.
Okay, I'm recommending 1 year probation. Alcohol, urine compliance testing, taking and passing all parts of the EBAS, and providing, I see your confusion because I was redundant in the compliance part, and then getting the documentation from the court in Wake County.
Okay, so the probation involves urine testing, right?
Yes.
So that requires a consent agreement?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so grant with
Sorry, would have to agree to the consent agreement, and if not, then would the motion include denial of license, and it would have to be specific on what?
Did you hear that, Dr. Bennett?
I did not hear the first part.
So if we're going to give him the opportunity to get a license on a probationary status with a consent agreement, he may choose not to sign the consent agreement, and if he doesn't, does that mean that his license would be denied, and under what grounds?
It would be denied on the grounds of being at – well, first off, we don't we have to, what I'm reading here is that there's a protocol. If we deny it, then we follow the protocol that's outlined here in our board briefing, correct?
Question. I just think you, they want you to be specific for the record on, so what rules are we denying under? What are the options?
Unprofessional conduct.
It's 921C.
Threat to public safety.
Threat to the public safety, yes. I'm sorry, I don't have those statutes in front of me.
I understand.
It's a 5921C.
Right, but that to tie it, you'd have to tie it to a ground of unprofessional conduct. C5. Do you want to maybe ask Dr. Lessard if he would be agreeable to a consent agreement?
Dr. Lessard, you've heard what is on the table right now as we work through the details. Are you willing to be on a probationary status for the first year and prove that you are abstaining from drugs and alcohol with random drug screening? And is that acceptable to you and providing the documentation regarding the proof of payment of fees?
I have no problems giving you guys the proof of fees, but I'm not going to move to Arizona to start off on probation when these are things from my past. My professional license and my certification have nothing against them. Professionally, there's no marks against me. So I don't see myself moving forward to up and move to Arizona to start out on probation for things in my past. It's just not something I'm willing to do.
Okay, so you would need to withdraw your application then? You'd be willing
to offer that as an option to Dr. Lessard.
I'm sorry?
And so in lieu of us denying your licensure today, you could withdraw your application.
Okay.
Otherwise, we're going to make a formal decision on your license and deny it, and it's going to show up as you being denied in other places that you apply for.
Yeah, I'll withdraw then. What are the steps I need to do there?
Dr. Lessard, if you wanted to contact either myself or Ms. Shapiro, either by email or by phone after the board meeting.
If just for the record, then the board would need to accept that withdrawal. So it'd be a motion to allow him to withdraw his application.
Okay.
Okay. Now, just point of clarity. So I think Dr. Bennett made a motion, and I don't know if we ever got a second on that. Do you want to withdraw your motion, Dr. Bennett?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, so now we need another motion to...
to allow Dr. Lessard to withdraw his application.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we allow Dr. Lessard to withdraw his application for licensure in Arizona.
I'll second.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, I'll call for the question. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Are there any opposed? Okay. The ayes have it. Thank you, Dr. Lessard. Good luck.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. All right. And then our final tab on licensure is tab number 12, Dr. Daniel Coughlin. Dr. Coughlin, are you present?
I am. You. Sorry, I'm having a technical difficulty here.
Okay. We can hear you with a little bit of an echo. Can you say your name for the record?
Yes. Hold on. Okay, so I had my phone connected and my computer battery's low, so had it going as a backup. So I'm here. My name's Daniel Coughlin.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Shapiro.
Chairman Guarino, members of the board, Dr. Coughlin submitted an application for licensure by examination and PMMTP certification on May 14th. Records indicate that Dr. Coughlin had a medical malpractice settlement on July 24th, 2018 for alleged vertebral artery dissection. Dr. Coughlin holds an active license in California.
Okay, Dr. Coughlin, can you give us some of the details about the vertebral artery dissection? We've read the materials. Do you have anything extra to add?
No, it was an auto accident injury. She was injured in the car accident and screened at the hospital, and everything had checked out clear, so it landed in a large lawsuit that really didn't go anywhere. We settled that for a very small amount.
Okay. Board members, do you have questions for Dr. Coughlin?
I do not.
Dr. Bennett?
None.
Dr. Knopf?
I'll make the motion to grant licensure upon payment of appropriate fees.
Second the motion.
Okay, Ms. Powell seconded. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Are there any opposed? Okay, the ayes have it. Congratulations, Dr. Coughlin. You'll receive a license in Arizona.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. So we're moving on to board business, and I've got our presenter, Dr. Jason Yeager, patiently waiting in the wings for a couple of hours now. So I want to give him the opportunity and take our agenda out of order and go to tab number 16. Hi, Dr. Yeager.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for entertaining me today. How's your day going?
Splendid.
Nice to see you all.
Yep. So I wanted to thank you for offering to clarify how the ethics and boundaries assessment services evaluations works. I've been to several of the FCLB and NBC meetings, and I've learned a lot going to them, and I've seen a lot of the presentations, but not all of our board members have had that privilege to do that. So I know that you'll add some much needed clarity as to how the examination works, the scientific validity of it, the how it's used across other healthcare boards, including nursing and dentistry and medical, et cetera, and just the importance of the breakdown of how the test is administered in the different categories and what passing means and what it doesn't. But also, you know, we've thrown around our board a little bit, you know, is this a disciplinary action or not? When we're trying to get to a point where we've got a doctor in front of us who says, yep, I know that, you know, what I did was wrong and I'm never going to do it again. You know, this is a useful tool to really get some objective information and some good testing so that our board members can make a better decision with a little bit of information other than just hearing a doctor's testimony and saying, yeah, I kind of think you figured it out. But so with that, you have the floor.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you so much. I appreciate the time today. So my name is Jason Yeager. I'm past president for the Nevada Chiropractic Board of Physicians, and I'm currently serving as your District 4 representative and a board member to the National Board of Chiropractic Examiners. I've been in practice for over 20 years and started my career in Arizona as well. So I appreciate you entertaining me today. We're going to go over three subjects for the specialty exams. As Dr. Guarino detailed, we will go over the spec exam, which is an exam that will test clinical competency. We're going to go over the jurisprudence exam, which Arizona still administers as well as Nevada. This is a preventative measure, frankly, to try to keep folks from having to come before your board. And then finally, the EBAS, which is an ethical testing, and some of the neat changes that have happened to EBAS. I also want to give recognition to Dr. Bennett. I noticed he had suggested EBAS test with one of the former potential licensees earlier, and I appreciate that. So without further ado, on the second page of the document that you have up, this covers our summary of the three subjects we're going to go over. On the third page, basically the spec exam is to certify chiropractors that they are clinically safe when there's been a malpractice scenario. The other use for your board is to ensure chiropractors have the clinical experience and expertise to be able to be competent for licensure or relicensure with the state of Arizona. I would also go outside of that, and I was looking this morning at where Arizona allows reciprocity. I see that you include and allow reciprocity from a few states: Alaska, Colorado, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Missouri, and Ohio. In those reciprocity opportunities with those states, the eligibility requirements in Arizona include having passed Part 1, Part 2, Part 3, as well as the spec exam. So the spec exam really is a keen tool if there was ever an opportunity for Arizona to open up to the remaining states in the United States where you can really assess if somebody, for example, has a license in Nevada, if they've taken parts 1 through 4, you could require the spec, and it would give you an excellent pulse of their competence. The exam can only be administered in a vote by an order from your board, so it's not something that a licensee or a potential licensee can just ask to do. We offer it 6 times per year. There's no cost to Arizona, your board, or your budget. And then we basically will cover 9 areas of clinical expertise that will cover the spectrum of the chiropractic education. Let me pause there and ask any of the board members if you guys have questions about spec. Great. Hearing none, the examination price to the examinee, to the licensee or potential licensee, is currently $1,500. Now, the next item I want to go to will be number 6, page 6, the jurisprudence exam. Arizona, again, like my home state, Nevada, currently administers and offers the jurisprudence examination. And to the administrative staff, I'd like to ask, is this something that is an easy, uncumbersome task, or is it quite involved? I think I saw a smile or a frown from Mrs. Shapiro.
Dr. Yeager, I would like to tell you that we did, Mona Leonard and I sat for a month and developed a new exam and searched for an online portal or platform, and then we got your PDF. So I think we're just about a month or two late.
Oh, my goodness. Well, if the board doesn't mind indulging me, what we could offer, or would you like me to just skip past it?
No, we'd like to hear it.
Okay, great. The big thing is the administration and the updating of the exam that you just spoke to, Mrs. Shapiro. The NBCE can take this over for you. Now, of course, again, jurisprudence is preventative. This is to make sure that we never have to have a licensee in Arizona come before you because of the learning opportunities from the jurisprudence exam. On page 17, you'll see that we would work directly with the test you prepared or directly with you in emboldening and improving this exam based on Arizona laws and statutes. Even more exciting, we will do this at no cost to the Arizona board. This is a courtesy and a thank you from the NBC and a gift back to this body to develop a product that is robust and honors what your jurisprudence examination needs will be. You'll have full and final approval of anything that comes out as a test. We can do proctored exams, and we can also set up an online platform. The cost will range, which would be a pass-through to the licensee, of as low as $55, and it would go up to being as high is $100. On page 8, you'll see that the majority of the United States currently still is utilizing jurisprudence as a preventative measure. And again, the NBCE supports how robust and important jurisprudence is. On to page 10, a sample jurisprudence exam would be, for example, 15% of the weight would be licensing requirements. 20% would be office management. Patient care could be 30%, and then professional conduct could be 35% of your examination. Turnaround time for this test would be a 1 to 2 week turnaround time. The NBC would be willing to enter into a 1, a 3, or a 5 year agreement with your board, and we would be able to guarantee what we would offer, the services, the administration, and also fixing the rates. There would not be any surprise change in what our rates or our fees would be. I also want you to know that this is a no-profit scenario for the NBCE and simply truly an altruistic service that we would offer to Arizona. Let me pause there and ask if the administrative team or any of the board members have any questions for me on jurisprudence.
Jason Wayne Bennett. Did you say that I understood you to say that the product comes in either an online or a proctored version. Would the online version have a faster turnaround than the proctored, or is that a factor?
It's not a factor, and we would still be about a 1 week, 2 week turnaround time. Is that prohibitive for this board?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Dr.
This is Dr. Knopf. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. How many other states currently use your platform for their jurisprudence?
Wonderful question. We're in our infancy. Right now, we are active with Oregon and with Florida, and we are currently about to or in the middle of going live with Oklahoma. And bear with me, there's one other state that we've gone live with. Give me a moment to scroll my notes. South Carolina. In addition, we have also taken over jurisprudence for the American Board of Chiropractic Pediatrics, and outside of the chiropractic field, the American Academy of Motor Vehicle Injuries, which I understand to be a multidisciplinary certification.
Okay, and then what about retention of records? Do you hold passing scores for all time, and can requests come from both the board as well as individuals that have taken the test, or would only board members and staff be able to access records for past completed scores?
That's a good question. We would hold scores for all times. As far as who we notify, I can't tell you definitively if it's both a licensee applicant and the board, or if it's just directly to the board. I think that those are nuances that we could work out based on the preference of Arizona.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you. All right. Well, I appreciate those questions. To the final part of our test, this board is using EBATS. So on page 12, you'll currently see that the current testing for EBATS historically has been a multiple choice test, as well as being a mandatory $1,500 fee. We're currently offering ethics testings in not only our field, but medical, social working, counseling, dental, as well as nursing. We are excited that we have been able to break out the different subject matters of EBAS. And let's take, for example, an alcohol or a drug abuse offender licensee versus, for example, a sex offender licensee. Realistically, either the board or the offender may not need to take the alcohol or the sexual abuse categories of the test. Maybe unnecessary and redundant. So we're happy to report that we can break out our different subject matters now, and each subject would just be a $300 fee, which again is a pass-through to the licensee after being ordered by Arizona. The other big change that we've made based off of our psychometrician, and that's Dr. Igor Himmelfarb, is that in our prior EBAS testing, we were multiple choice. Multiple choice, we found, was not psychometrically sound. Basically, it was very, very easy to identify what the right answer was, and it didn't give a good assessment of the place in the improvement of the licensee offender. Now the examination is essay format. We have a team that are put together of graders that are former board administrators, former board licensees, and people well-versed and trained in the ability to read and grade and score in an essay format. The pass rate is 82%. In other words, you must get an 82% pass, and the results passed directly to the Arizona Board. With that, let me also pause and ask if there's any questions with the exciting updates of our EBAS test.
Jason, yeah, Wayne Bennett again. The broken out rendition, the $300 version, is that also a more brief experience, or is that the same length but everything focused on one subject?
More brief experience, Dr. Bennett.
Thank you.
Dr. Yeager, I see that there's other professions listed here that are currently testing. What's about the percentage breakdown for usage between those professions? So, for example, I think this is the brainchild of chiropractor, so I have to assume chiropractic is one of the bigger categories. But what's the breakdown for the rest of the users going through testing?
What I'd like to do, if I may, is I'm going to email you guys back with that exact breakdown. You're correct that it's heavily weighted and overwhelmingly chiropractic, since the genesis of NBCE is as a chiropractic testing organization. If I may just peel off and go on a rabbit hole for a moment, it's the intent and the direction of the NBCE board to aggressively pursue testing and licensure and examinations in other fields in both the United States, and to also standardize testing throughout the world internationally. This is an exciting thing for us, and there's a downstream vision that we can ultimately reduce and, God willing, even eliminate testing fees to the chiropractic profession. So our ability to expand out into these other healthcare providers is going to be our path for that to happen.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Okay, well, I really want to thank you all for allowing me to be here today. If there's an interest in me following up with the administrative team on jurisprudence, whether that be now or sometime in the near or far future, please don't hesitate to reach out to myself directly or Dr. Norman Utz, the executive director for the NBCE. I sure wish that I was able to get in front of you guys earlier in the year, but I'll remain hopeful there's a chance.
Thank you, Dr. Yeager.
All right, everybody take care.
Okay. Let us move on to tab number 14, and we can go through our board meeting minutes. Okay, so I'm looking at the 5/26/21 executive session minutes draft. Only one page. Are there any corrections?
Did you say only one page?
One page? Yeah, for the executive session.
Oh, thank you.
Move to the meeting minutes for the executive session.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Okay, the ayes have it, and they are approved. And now let's go back to the open session meeting minutes for the same day. Go through it page by page. I have page one. Page two of 10.
Page two, Mr. Chairman.
Yes?
First line, it says records request delay was minor and were released. So we need to correct the grammar.
What line?
Number one.
First. How about
line five.
Delay was minor, but were eventually released? And were eventually released or soon released?
And were soon released.
Yeah. That's fine. We're soon released.
Okay. If you think of something else, just let me know. I'm not married to that.
Okay. And in the second paragraph, should be hear from an attorney, not form an attorney.
Okay. So line number five.
Thank you.
Got it? Okay. How about page number 3 of 10?
Line number 18, the word weather is incorrectly spelled given the context.
Also line five.
Also line five. Oh, thank you.
Okay, page four. Page five. Page six.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Line one. Let's see.
What about line one?
This is just cumbersome. I don't even quite understand what it means.
I got you, Dr. Bennett. Dr. Hubbard, provide opening remarks, period. Dr. Bidlack denies.
You could just eliminate the word but, put a period there, and have a second sentence.
That's what I'm doing.
Okay.
Okay, line number eight, it says, mention not get no close to patients. I think maybe not get too close. EOO.
Uh-huh.
Okay. About page number seven. Page eight.
Page eight, line five. Four and five. Dr. Knopf stated that the imaging provided is not diagnostic and is therefore a reason to open a complaint and get more information. I said is therefore not a reason to open a complaint.
Because of the labeling, or I don't remember what.
It was only one view.
Okay.
So Dr. Knopf stated the imaging provided was not diagnostic and is not a reason.
Correct.
Okay.
Page nine. And finally, page 10. Okay. Move to approve as amended.
I'll make the motion to approve the minutes as amended.
Second the motion.
Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the ayes have it. Let's move on to tab number 15, Mr. Bohol.
Start with the budget report. As of the June 21st, we are at 97% of the fiscal year that it's elapsed. We've expended or plan to expend about 96% of our revenue. That won't take into account the final payday of the fiscal year, which will occur, I believe, on July 1st. I'd have to double check, but.
You're right.
I apologize. We received 96% of our estimated revenue and paid out 89% of our appropriation. And I can get to this when I get to the legislative part, about the Senate and the budget. Moving on to licensing, staff has issued 11 licenses in between May 26th and 22nd of the board's meeting. And that list is provided to you. In the investigations report, as of June 15th, we have 40 cases that are pending in the investigative phase, 33 that are prepared for initial appearance or formal interview, and we'll work on getting those before the board in the next couple months. We have four that are pending consent agreement or draft order that we're working on drafting those and issuing out those orders, zero that are pending formal hearing, and then we had four cases that were on the agenda for resolution today, which is a total of 81 cases. And then talk to you about the legislative update. I'll go right for the budget, starting with SB 1823. The Senate did move forward with the budget last night and passed their version of it. It'll now go over to the House for their approval. I believe they started meeting at 10 o'clock today. To deliberate on that. So hopefully they'll get something finished, finalized, and over to the governor before July 1st. This was a similar appropriation to what we received last year, so there'll be no changes to staffing numbers or the requested appropriation. That is mirrored in House Bill 2895. That's the General Appropriations Act for the House. The last bill that I wanted to highlight for you was HB 2454, which was the Telemedicine Expansion Act that was signed by the governor last month. It directs each of the licensing and regulatory boards to draft and create a telemedicine registry in which individuals that are licensed in other states can register and perform telemedicine within Arizona for Arizona citizens. I have later on the agenda to discuss the exempt rulemaking that was part of that for the board to consider on what action you'd like to take there. Do you have any questions on any of the reports? If not, I'd happily move to tab 17 to go into detail about proposed rulemaking. On the requirement of the telemedicine bill, as it said, requires the board to draft a registry and allows for the board to conduct exempt rulemaking for 1 year. In order to get that registry up, I don't believe that we need too many details and rules, but what we do need is clarity on the fee that the board would like to charge for enrolling in that registry. It is a one-time fee that would need to capture both staff time in processing the registration, but also any investigation into complaints that may arise. I've heard different numbers from different agencies, around $250 for the registration. You could also consider something similar to your application fee, which I believe is about $250 as well.
Justin, how are they using the application? Because there's some states where you have to be a licensed professional providing the application, and other states it can be any unlicensed person running a telehealth company. What does that look like with other boards?
The law specifies that it needs to be a licensed provider with the same training and education and same level in order to get that license, and that's required as part of the application process that they have to attest to that, and staff would need to confirm that practice level with the other states that they're licensed in. And the bill does give the board jurisdiction over complaints, and that they have to attest that they'll adhere to Arizona law and rule and submit to the board's jurisdiction for investigation.
Dr. Bennett, any questions?
Oh, yeah. my first question is that this bill specifically, it specifically applies to hospital, medical, dental, and optometric service corporations. And so I'm not sure that my sense is that we are specifically not included as doctors of chiropractic in the language here. And so does that impact any ability for us to participate and respond? My first question.
Okay. I believe you might be looking at the Title 20. I'll have to double check, but I do believe that the chiropractic profession was included.
I'm looking at HB 2454.
Right. I think Justin gave you the summary.
Yes.
The whole bill.
I'll pull up the whole bill for you.
Yes. Dr. Bennett, members of the board, the chiropractic board is specifically included in that.
Did you hear that, Dr. Bennett? We are specifically included in that bill.
Okay. I would like to see that whole bill then, because we're not included in the language that I'm reading. Okay.
I will confirm that that's true, and I will send out the full text of the bill for you.
Okay, or I can look it up. I mean, there's no need for you to send it to me. I'll just look up the bill itself. And that does kind of change the tenor of what I was going to say. But just by general comment, this legislation does a lot of things in terms of setting some much needed benchmarks with regard to telehealth practice. and it would behoove us to be part of this population to that extent. I did not really fully grasp that this is an attempt to establish something like a provider compact, but I don't know, like almost like a compact light. And so it gives then rise to questions like if you're doing a compact, then it's necessary to have in place, number one, specific legislation in your statute identifying the compact and a different board of directors and a whole different database, provider database network that can be accessed by other compact members. And is this our state's version of like a compact light? And if so, how are we addressing some of those issues with regard to portability of provider information?
I don't think that this could be considered a compact or a compact light. I think this was an expansion of telemedicine solely for Arizona. This was an extension of the governor's executive order. I think it was 2020-034, which was about telemedicine during the pandemic. And this was the codified in law version of that. So I wouldn't consider this a compact or something that an Arizona chiropractor could take to go to other states. This was just allowing a licensed individual in another state to practice telemedicine in the state of Arizona.
Well, and I that's correct. But in so doing, that's establishing a means by which that out-of-state provider can provide care to a patient in our state. That's the portability of a practice, and that's mm-hmm. what a compact is. And so they're a subset of each other. And so I guess I can't believe that other provider groups. You know, the medical doctors have compacts in Arizona, the PTs, the nurses, they all have compacts already in Arizona. And so I'm just very curious about that. We don't need to spend a lot of time going in the weeds on this, perhaps a sidebar conversation on it. But it seems to me like there are steps being taken here that are sort of aggressive relative and may get in the way or complicate the actual existence of a compact as regards telehealth. And so just an observation. But overall, I think this is good. And so what do we need to do to mobilize to be part of this?
So the first part would be to go through that exempt rulemaking to define what a fee would be. Staff would develop the application process and the registration the registry for maintaining that information.
So that the registry is kind of like the provider database. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
And this would be done by provider. So if you were, let's say, a medical doctor and you employed 50 other medical doctors, you can't have all the other 50 medical doctors if you were the single applicant for an entity. We're saying any provider who wants to give or provide care in the state through telemedicine would have to be individually registered.
That's correct. It's not the business entity form. It's only the provider.
And we as a profession, as part of the exempt rulemaking process, need to establish how we are going to manage that provider database?
I believe that's stated in the law. The only thing that was given to the boards for your discretion is the amount charged on the application for the initial registration.
Okay, then I misunderstood you. I thought that part of what our staff was supposed to do to come up with a fee was to determine how much work product was going to have to go into the establishment of this portable database thing. And that's a huge undertaking. I couldn't imagine that we'd be scrambling to do that each provider group on our own. That was what I was say?
I think what we would need to consider is just the staff time in processing the initial application, which I would say that it's a little bit less than a standard application, but there's a lot of attempt to verify with the other states through their website and different things. So I'd say it's a similar application cost.
And then are we just saying the established database could be an Excel file with the registrants listed that we're saving? It doesn't have to be something fancy that we...
Correct.
That. Got it.
That's not consistent with my understanding. My understanding based upon, and you know, my context is that I'm chairing the telehealth committee for the FCLB, and we just finished doing a survey of 50 states on this subject, amongst others. And the portability of provider information between states to accommodate telehealth is a very, you know, the importance of it being a universal format and that data be portable and quickly so and reporting times and all that stuff. It's a subject of significant concern. And so it doesn't make sense to me that we would be able to do something, you know, quick and dirty on a local level when that kind of stuff is going on globally.
Well, I guess I don't. Are you talking, Dr. Bennett, from like almost a credentialing process where you're validating the providers?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Or where it runs them against like the national practitioner database and sees if they can participate in Medicare programs and things like that?
Yes.
Is that a requirement?
What the application requirements, the information that we gather is limited to what the statute allows. So that limits the expanse of the database, essentially.
I mean, if we're worried about there are programs that exist where you can credential individuals within 24 hours for like $15 that you can build in the cost of that. If there's something more extensive that we wanted to do.
I'm not sure how much further this conversation is going to get us. I just feel like we need to clarify whose database is what, and let me just read the language of the statute, and then we can move on. But absolutely, I think we should pursue this and get involved in the exempt rulemaking process.
What is the governor's time constraint for us to act on this and come up with a fee?
The legislation was effective immediately, and that was signed in May. So,
okay.
I would expect
so we need to come up with a fee today to comply with this and get it rolling, and then modify it if we can.
I would agree with that.
We're being force-fed, Dr. Bennett.
Okay.
So how much will it cost us to comply with this is what we're after today. And I'm going to throw out $220.
I would believe
per
that
applicant.
That's reasonable.
Does anybody want to go higher or lower?
The only reason why I would
follow.
The only reason why I would go higher, we're essentially providing out-of-state providers access to Arizona patients and potentially taking from our own licensees. And so to have access on such a broad level, I think merits a higher price for registration.
Is that consistent with the mission of the Arizona Board of Chiropractic Examiners protecting the public? Concern of ours?
I would note that there is cost associated with this, so there's not a suggested level. But what I could suggest is set the fee, and with all of your other fees that you review annually, you can see how, if that's cost prohibitive or if that's a too low of a cost, we can adjust on a reflective basis.
I mean, it's part of the intent of the bill to encourage, I mean, part of our fee structure is so that we encourage chiropractors to come to Arizona and practice here, which is why we've traditionally been one of the better fee states in the country. I mean, is the idea that the same idea applies, that we want to have just a wealth of telemedicine providers? Or is it that we want to give patients this option, but we still need to protect the ones that are practicing at state?
I believe that the intent would be to provide this option to the citizens, but not be cost prohibitive.
Okay. I would think
it's supposed to be the cost. It's not, I mean, it just basically what is the administrative cost? And that's a fairly narrow bandwidth. I mean, isn't it? Are there other boards that are consistent in terms of provider populations to ours that have already done this?
Everybody's kind of working at it at the same time. That nothing's been solidified, but I will say that about 250 is where I'm hearing that bar being set.
Okay, I say we go 250.
Okay. Do we need a motion for that, or?
I would say
motion. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
So, Dr. Bennett, you make that motion for 250. Is there a second?
I'll
got a second by Dr. Knopf. And any further discussion? Okay, I'm going to call for the question. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Are there any opposed? Okay, the ayes have it. 250 it is. Paul was outbid. That's 210. Okay. I think that brings us to the call to the public, which is our opportunity to hear from anybody in the audience. We can't reply to anything that's said, but what would you like to say? Anybody? Nobody? How about online? Anybody want to make a call to the public? Okay, hearing none, I will entertain a final motion to adjourn.
I'll make the motion to adjourn.
Okay, is there a second? Okay, those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
All right, it's 12:39.